Hello again, friends, and you are my friends, and welcome to another edition of 605, the Super Podcast, the only podcast on Turner Time, the Mothership. As always, I am the great Brian Last, and with me, some of you may know him as Akeem Bixenspan's cousin, others may know him as a Sliphouse boy, but I think we all know him as the leading author of sensual and erotic wrestling writing, the one and only David Bixenspan. Bix! I'm going to give him a second to laugh. How you doing, Bix?
I was going to try to make some kind of Orlando Wilson's fishing podcast joke, but I couldn't think of one in time.
You know, I was thinking that your what was it? HW Heart Wrestling? Was that the name?
Hearts Wrestlers or something like that.
Hearts Wrestlers, your pseudonym on that old ring rat. You could take those stories and you could apply them if you could find people with like a circus fetish, because you have a giant and a fat man and a bearded lady and Dutch Mantel and Elegante and Abdullah the Butcher. Just take those stories, change, get rid of the names.
Why is Dutch Mantel a bearded lady?
Well, I'm just trying to think of a way you can utilize that story to make a few bucks. I'm looking out for you. You're my friend. Otherwise, it's just some hairy, dirty guy.
I guess maybe I could try to market one of those kind of sarcastic 50 Shades of Grey types of books.
You know, other than just the mustache, it really did seem like he got hairier as the years went on. Like, he wasn't as hairy in 1983 as he was in 1993, was he?
He was trying to please Ric Flair.
Oh, no hair, no flair. You know, sometimes it takes me a second to get these remarks. But anyway, I think last week's show was very popular with all of our salacious material.
That's one way to put it, for sure.
That is a yes. Well, a little bit of a follow-up. I actually, great thing about the 605 Super Podcast Facebook page, which is facebook.com/superpodcast, is it's a great way for you to reach out to us, and we hear everything you say. And Dan Leonard got in touch this week, Bix, the author of Confessions of a Ring Rat, the man who interviewed Sue Shooter, or as she is now known in the 605 Super Universe, Sue the Shooter. And the first remark Dan said to me was, and I wrote down the exact quote, "Your accent is truly atrocious." So thanks, Dan. But he did say that she had a funny accent of her own, and she is unabashed in that she is a giant ring rat and she loves wrestlers, and all the wrestlers down there know her. There was a documentary film made about her, and I actually don't have the name in front of me. I know I posted it the other day. But there's a documentary film that was made about her in Australia.
It's available on DVD.
Is it available on DVD? I looked for
it. It's available on DVD in Australia.
In Australia. So if you have a region-free DVD player somewhere else, you can get that and watch it. And apparently she had a few tragedies the last few years. She was married to a guy, and he was killed by I don't even know if it was a drunk driver or just a crazy driver. So she was all over the news. He sent me the news clip of her being interviewed on the news about the death of her husband. So that's very sad to hear. But he said that there was nothing that embarrassed her. She just put it all out there and thought it was all great. And that made me feel better about the story and the impression last week, Bix.
Well, you could kind of tell, though,
that you
she
think?
Was on a... Yes, of course.
Yeah, I don't imagine her saying, like, "I don't want to tell the Wee Willie Wilson story. I'll save that one. It's embarrassing. I'll talk about the fully grown wrestlers. Did I ever tell you my story of Dutch Mantel? He was like being with a bearded lady." All right. Well, anyway, Sue the Shooter, the character, will return to the show at some point in the future. So
I think she's going to be a bigger hit than the Black Scorpion was.
I think maybe her and the Black Scorpion have to meet. I just don't know how that would actually work. So there may have to be some planning involved to make that.
You mean
that.
Because you would get laryngitis?
Sue the Shooter I could do all day and all night. Black Scorpion, although I'm not going to fully admit that it's me, it could be, you know, the Black Scorpion. But when I do that voice, it really kills my throat. Because I'm not putting on any vocal effects or anything. I'm actually just doing, you know, I'm doing the voice live. And that takes a lot out of my throat. So, and I'll introduce more characters as the show goes on when appropriate. Or maybe I'll have Sue the Shooter read that Jimmy Snuka article. That may be fun. But moving forward from there, Bix, A lot of people really liked our Buzz Sawyer piece last week about his training school. And I want to give everyone a heads up. We are working now on doing a full piece about Buzz Sawyer's training school, including interviewing Jason Rudy. Jason is the listener, a nice guy who sent us all the footage last week and told me all about the show, about being in that school and what it was like. And we're going to have him on the show to talk about what it was like to actually be a student in Buzz Sawyer School. And then a second person, whose name currently slips my mind, and I got to make sure he wants his name out there too, hit me up that he was at Buzz Sawyer School. He wasn't a trainee. He was a fan. And Buzz slapped him. So we're going to get that story as well. We're going to have full coverage of the Buzz Sawyer Training School. You know, 25 years too late. But we we will have this on the air, Bix. And did you think of Buzz differently after you saw that entire video last week? It was in our video playlist.
A little. We saw him acting somewhat normal, but that's just somewhat. He's still Buzz Sawyer. I mean, we've heard things, to say the least.
Yeah, we've heard things, to say the least. You know, someone brought it up that when Ken Shamrock was on Steve Austin's podcast, and I think I had heard this at the time and I'd forgotten it. Ken Shamrock seems to be of the belief that Buzz Sawyer was murdered by drug dealers.
What did he die of?
He died of a drug overdose. But Ken Shamrock says it was in like a bathroom at a nightclub, and that he was given a hot dose. He was given something that was going to kill him intentionally. So we need to look into that. Ken Shamrock knows a thing or two about drugs and drug tests. So maybe we reach out to him. I don't know if he'll be receptive at all, but we have a whole list of people we've reached out to. There's Coco Ware, no word back. There's Markeline. We are still actively chasing down Markeline, and every week I feel like we have a lead, and I could tell you that we've been told he wants to come on and talk, and he's just hard to – I mean, I'm guessing maybe he went back to Singapore for the fight sport, Bix.
Down in the melting pot of sin, as Carrie Hart would call it.
Yeah, I mean, if you're going to quote anyone, quote Guleen. Don't quote a different manager. The melting pot of sin. I thought that was Sue the Shooter's bedroom. Gary called me his girlfriend. But we're actively still trying to get Markeline on the show to talk about various things, including Yo Mamba, the Jungle Savage.
Yes. It's with him. I'm glad he wants to come on, apparently. Although I wonder if he'll be confused by the whole concept of, so we don't want to talk about when you actually wrestled or anything. We primarily want to talk about like the 6 weeks that you were a manager, but I hope that's cool.
There's so much to talk to him about, though. It's, where did you come up with that accent? How long have you been practicing those promos? What did you think when they had Tejo Khan jump out of the lake?
Were you some kind of theater actor, and that's where the accent and stuff came from? Were you? What was it like being the drummer in the Jeff Jarrett Dutch Mantel thing?
Well, you know, he was trained by Bill Dundee, and when he was still managing, I think maybe when he was out there with the Rockers, maybe it was with Tejo, Dundee was out there, and Dundee called him out for his accent. He's like, this ridiculous fake accent you're doing. So we want to definitely crack down on that.
Yeah,
He's like one – like I would say the two I want the most are Markeline and El Pibe Diaz.
What about Sue the Shooter?
I don't know. I'm intimidated to speak to Sue the Shooter. Okay. Unless we do Sue the Shooter speaking to Sue Shooter.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, which could end up being disastrous. And they're in Australia. What's the time difference if we did want to record that?
15 or 16 hours.
Bloody lovely.
We'd have to do it in the morning or at night, I guess.
Yeah. I can't do it tonight. I'll be with Tiger Jeet Singh. That was
Who else I bet she would like to be with?
Yo Mamba, the Jungle Savage.
Maybe raise the volume up on that a little bit, Bix.
Okay.
Yes, it sounded like he was 15 hours away in Australia, right there for that clip. Well, we talked about Mad Dog Buzz Sawyer. Speaking of dogs, and speaking of clips, Bix and I were going through some stuff, trying to find some funny stuff for the show here, and found something I'd never seen before. I think it's the Spectrum in Philly, Bix, right? I mean, because Mel Phillips is the ring announcer.
I think so.
Well, it's going to be Hercules Hernandez against the Junkyard Dog. So Hercules Hernandez showed up in, when was he there? 86, right?
Like, yeah, no, but this is not 86. I mean, this looks like it's 87 or 88.
Yeah, he showed up, I guess, at the end of 85. Hercules Hernandez was there, managed by Fred Blassie. And Junkyard Dog in 85 was one of the biggest stars in the company and was involved in an angle with Mel Phillips where Terry Funk beat up Mel Phillips, and then Junkyard Dog came out the next week or a couple weeks later on Championship Wrestling to defend his fellow brother, his fellow black man. So Mel Phillips knew who Junkyard Dog was. And in this clip that we discovered, he somehow incredulously forgets the name of Junkyard Dog while doing the ring announcing. It's pretty embarrassing. Bix, do you have that clip?
Yes, I do. Because if there's anyone you want to defend the honor of, it's Mel Phillips.
Hey, Footsie Phillips.
All right, let's see.
Soon to be making his way to the ring area, his opponent from Charlotte, North Carolina, weighing 280 pounds, the Junkyard.
Now, after he says junk, he goes to get his cards because he remembers junk. He can't remember yard dog. That is just embarrassing. It's just embarrassing. How do you forget the name of the Junkyard Dog?
Any joke I could make would be too inappropriate.
Then you should definitely make it.
No.
Well, from that clip, well, we're going to have another clip in a second that cracked me up this week. So last week we talked about how maybe the Von Erichs should have had something going with the Russians. And goddamn, Bix, everyone reached out and said, Crusher Yurkov, you're forgetting Crusher Yurkov. That
doesn't count.
Doesn't count. Doesn't count. We're in complete agreement on this. Of course, if you don't know, Crusher Yurkov was Bam Bam Bigelow. And we brought up how the Koloffs and the Von Erichs would have been a really cool feud. Somewhere in that time, 84 to 86. And it actually would have worked in terms of the six-man title because you would have had Mike, Kerry, and Kevin against Ivan, Nikita, and Darso. So it would have actually worked out, you know, as a six-man feud. Well, Mike Campbell, a devoted listener of the show, nice guy, he sent me – there was actually a mock-up, like, what-if article in the Aptor mags in, like, 1985 about this. What if the Russians and the Von Erichs feuded?
With the same conceit about the Olympics?
You know, I didn't actually read the article. I just looked at the pictures. I got to admit, I'll check on that.
So you read the article as if we were still 4 years old?
Yes.
Okay.
I never really liked reading the Aptor mags because I knew they were full of shit.
Okay.
I never did. Hold on. Let me see if I can pull it up.
Not a fan of Dr. Sidney Basil?
No, not a fan. Dan Shockett was all right. But let's see. I have it right here. I'm pulling it up.
Not a fan of Liz Hunter and the Easy Liz contest.
The Koloffs and I don't see anything here about the Olympics.
Huh.
Which would have been the natural thing. If the match is made, it promises to be the biggest collision in the history of six-man tag team wrestling. It pits the most fearsome team the Soviet Union can produce against a family that represents the best of America. There is so much at stake and so much danger involved for all concerned, it is more than a match. It is a war. Not bad.
I guess.
And yeah, nothing about the Olympics, which would have been the natural thing. But anyway, so we have a clip. Last week when I was putting together the video playlist that Alan Blackstock does, Get Well, Alan, if you aren't well already, I was looking for some Koloff interviews, and I found one that could only be described as Nikita Koloff talking gibberish. Now, he was never exactly Mr., you know, easy to understand. But this one, you could make out the word Ric Flair and Uncle Ivan, even though he just slurs those words.
But he's speaking Russian. How do you – we don't speak Russian.
This is the biggest amount of gibberish. It's just in the Nikita voice. And,
I think it's just Russian. I think we don't understand their beautiful language.
Okay, well, why don't you play it, and we'll see if it's just Russian or malarkey.
The world heavyweight champion Ric Flair viewed the tape, and like I said, I don't think I've ever seen Ric Flair as upset, as irate as he was right here on TV.
Ric Flair, come on, the autumn, Uncle Ivan.
Uh-huh. So he starts off by Ric Flair. Obviously, he ends with Uncle Ivan, and it's just in the middle. Blah, 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 and he just passes it off right away.
Do we know what year this is?
If he's talking about Ric Flair, maybe 85?
I mean, it could be 86, too. I know if he's a heel, it's 85. Yeah.
Yeah. Because he was a babyface at the end of 86.
So he's been Nikita for a year. I mean, was there a point where he started speaking English?
That's a good...
Just randomly pretending to speak Russian all of a sudden.
Play it again. Play it again, Bix. I want to really analyze this.
The World Heavyweight Champion Ric Flair viewed the tape, and like I said, I don't think I've ever seen Ric Flair as upset, as irate as he was right here on TV.
There's no attempt at trying to make it sound like it was any words at all there.
It's the Russian equivalent of the Swedish chef.
You know, that's a very good way of putting it, Bix.
I mean, it's basically Nikita Koloff doing the Russian equivalent of burk de burk de burk, burk de burk de burk.
Isn't a story that Nikita used to talk like that even when he was on, like, the private jet with Crockett people? That one, like, he would just keep doing that voice like he didn't speak English?
I know Ivan did. I don't know if Nikita did. But, I mean, Nikita was in character, like, always in public and stuff.
I think Jim Cornette may have said it, that Nikita would be in character on the private Crockett jet, and then Arn Anderson called him out for it one day. Oh, man. Well, I think you guys have just heard what will be our next drop on the show that we often just jump in with.
I have something. It's not on YouTube, but maybe I should put it up or something. Have you ever seen... when, from early 1990, when the band Gorky Park showed up in the Sportatorium with Carrie Von Erich?
No.
So Gorky Park was one of the, you know, the in a Wayne's World sketch on SNL, the one where they do the top 10 reasons we're bummed about communism being dead or whatever it is?
I think so.
One of them is like no more lame Russian rock bands or something. And I guess Gorky Park was one of them. And they come on with a woman from, I forget her name, from something called Youthquake, which I guess is a local radio show or TV show. So you've got Carrie basically, from his like facial expressions, the way he's talking, seemingly trying to imply that he's had carnal relations with this woman.
Really?
And then talks about how Gorky Park stands for everything that the Von Erichs do. I forget all of them, but one of them is a drug-free. Fascinating piece of history. I should put it on YouTube or something.
I like that you think you can call it, you know, that he knew her carnally after we heard your porno fantasies last week. Like, we know.
Those aren't. Maybe spit take on the microphone. Thank
Don't
you.
Do it on the computer, Bix. We're going to have more problems with the show if you ruin the computer.
Well, I don't want to ruin the microphone either. I mean, the microphone's cheaper.
Who was the first person in a wrestling interview to call Carrie Von Erich Vinnie Barbarino? Was it Michael Hayes?
I have no idea.
All right. Well,
meanwhile.
Meanwhile, let me ask you this. So Nikita was the kayfabe nephew of the kayfabe Russian Ivan Koloff.
Yes.
And then later on, when he was working the indies, he had Vladimir Koloff. Who do you think is a more bullshit bootleg replacement? Vladimir Koloff or Demolition Blast?
Demolition Blast. Come on.
I remember seeing a picture of him in a magazine. I'm like, who's this fat guy wearing the makeup? Like, there was no muscle at all on the guy.
It just seemed like a random guy that Bill Eadie found. It's like, here's Demolition Blast.
Yeah, but you would think Bill Eadie would have had options to get someone in shape or someone who looked impressive.
Right. This was just a guy in a body stocking, kind of wearing LOD shoulder pads, that being called Demolition Blast.
Yeah. Right out of the Blue Oyster Bar.
Axe, smash, crush, blast.
Yeah, something doesn't add up there. That guy was the cheapest looking wrestler ever when I used to see him in those magazines. Although, again, Vladimir Koloff, it's like, just because he had a bald head, you know, he was
kind of hairy.
And yeah, he had the Dutch Mantel thing going on. No one went for a blonde Russian after Rocky IV, did they?
No, and it's strange, isn't it?
Yeah, there's no blonde Russian wrestlers.
Are we forgetting anyone?
Let's see. Rusev's not Russian. He's Bulgarian.
Even the shoot Russians in New Japan were all just dark-haired hair guys.
Yeah. Nikolai is like the lightest hair Russian I could think of right now off the top of my head.
Yes.
Well, there's that. I did want to say a couple other things.
Wait. What? Now we know. Well, now we have one. Lana.
Lana. Okay. I guess. What a ridiculous character that is. She could have been.
But that's only because she's supposed to be Mrs. Drago in the first place.
Yeah. She's totally Brigitte Nielsen in Rocky IV. But anyway. We are working, and I don't know how it's going to work and how we're going to get it done, but we're going to try to do sometime soon. And we have a lot of things coming up. We mentioned before that we have a Freebird episode coming up with some really cool audio that we're going to be playing to celebrate the Freebirds right around the time they go into the Hall of Fame. We have a multi-part Bobby Simmons interview, which I think everyone's going to really like, because he talks about the inner workings of Georgia for a 10-year period, stuff that I never really knew. How often was Ted Turner around the studio when they were filming? You know, what was Jim Barnett's way of paying out for the shows? How much did wrestlers get versus how much came in? All these really fascinating things. So really cool stuff. But one of the things we want to do pretty soon is a episode where we can actually have callers, where people can call in and talk to us. So that is something we're working on. We're trying to figure out the best way to do it. It may not be imminent, but just know it's in the works. That should be fun, Bix, right?
Yes, that should be fun.
Yeah,
possibly unpredictable. Probably unpredictable.
It would be completely unpredictable. Completely unpredictable. But that's what will make it fun. Where are we moving next, Bix?
Let's see.
Wait. I'm sorry. One more thing, because I'm an idiot.
Of course you are.
In the Confessions of a Ring Rat, the first sentence, I kind of stumbled over my words because I had said that Sue rooted some of the biggest wrestlers, and I thought it was a misprint and they left out the word rooted for. It turns out in Australia, rooted means fucking. So when I said she rooted four wrestlers, and I heard from numerous people, I don't know how many of them were actually from Australia, but I heard from numerous people just letting me have it, and including Dan Leonard, who loved my atrocious accent. So I just want to go out there and for the record now and say, we know I messed up. It won't happen again. I'm going to study my Australian slang and we will be better next time.
And so it's like Rogering?
Yeah. See, that's a guy like Rogering. That's a
Sean. When Sean Wheelock was on, I think it was when he was on Between the Sheets, it told me a great story about how when he was doing soccer for BBC, one time he said something like, nice tackle on whoever got tackled. Problem is that in the UK, tackle means something else. It means the your bait and tackle, I guess.
Wow. I bet
so
that
would his wife is British, so she had a lot of fun with that after.
I remember when I went over to England in 2006 and I was watching Monday Night Raw in a hotel room because there was nothing on in the middle of the night and Raw was on, surprisingly. And they had in the bottom corner a sign language person doing
Seen that. It's great.
Yeah. I was like more captivated by Raw than I've ever been before. I was like watching this woman do the sign language throughout the entire episode.
I've just never understood, though. Why is it that in lieu of the captions?
I mean, maybe it's just people. Yeah, that's a great question. I don't know. I was trying to bullshit an answer, and I couldn't do it.
But it's great. It's like watching I was going to say Garrett Morris, but that's not actually the same thing.
No, that's not in any way the same thing.
But I'm trying to think what the – but that was a parody of a real thing, wasn't it?
Well, yeah, and that ended up being parodied by Dutch Mantel and Bill Dundee in Memphis.
Right. So it's like watching a news for the hearing impaired type of thing, but only for wrestling?
No, it's actually for the hearing impaired.
Yes. No, but I thought the Garrett Morris thing was a parody of actual sign language in sets.
Oh, it was, but obviously they weren't just screaming.
You know? Our top story tonight.
Jim Jameson, I'm going to kill you. That was what Dundee said, I believe, in 86. So that's that. Rooted.
Speaking of Memphis.
Yes.
Thanks for giving me room for a segue.
hope you ride your Segway off a cliff.
That's that happens a lot, apparently.
That's the second time I hit you with that one. Yeah. Well, Segway.
I don't think that's English. Neither was what Ivan Koloff said. Or
Ivan.
Birth the Berkey Burke. Okay. We want to talk about how Lance Russell's 90th birthday was this past weekend. And a lot of photos on Twitter. Great photo of him with his cake. We are going to try to have him on soon. But you were the one who actually suggested we talk about him this week. So, I mean, I'll let you start. Because I, you know, I've interviewed, you know, I've talked to him plenty of times, interviewed him on podcasts and stuff. But also, I'll let you start because I know you probably share my views on him as far as being the greatest wrestling announcer of all time in that. But stories, yeah. Specifics, whatever, you start.
I love Lance Russell. I could watch anything with Lance Russell. Anything. Because, you know, Memphis is great, but there's some bad Memphis. And because he's there, I can watch it. And I think he's by far the best wrestling commentator slash host. Because I consider him more of a host than a commentator.
Yeah, well, he's also the best interview. Well, is he the best interview? I think he's right up there. It's either him or Okerlund. But Lance is definitely the best at getting angles over.
I would give him the edge over Okerlund just because Lance is so believable and he has credibility with anyone he deals with.
And I don't recall ever seeing Gene carry guys on interviews the way Lance did.
No. Gene would try to get himself over. There's a difference. Yeah. Lance got over by not trying to get himself over. Gene Okerlund would try to get himself over. And I don't mind. I love old Gene Okerlund. It's just he's hysterical and he's really good at it. But Lance Russell's in a league of his own. And, you know, as good as Dave Brown is, like, that period in the early 90s without Lance Russell, I don't enjoy it as much just because there's no Lance.
Which is, I mean, Dave Brown is great, though, but Dave Brown on his own is not as good as the Lance and Dave team.
Right. They're perfect together. And, you know, let me ask you this, Bix. There's so many great Lance Russell moments. If you had to pick one that was your very favorite, what would it be?
On Memphis TV?
Yeah, I mean, you better not say with Garvin and Hayes.
Okay. The whole thing with the Lawler's leading to Lawler's return after the Lose Leafs Town match in 86 is definitely up there, his performance in that. With everything with Jerry Jarrett crying and him telling him to not to come on camera and then how he handles everything with Eddie Marlin and everything after, there's that. The thing with Tojo, where he takes a hammer out of his desk in case Tojo tries to come at him.
Oh, yeah, that's great.
Lance Russell's nose, of course, his reaction to that. And the flower thing with Jimmy Hart. I don't know if I can pick a single.
No, if you needed one to show somebody to say this is who Lance Russell is.
See, I don't think you can think of one thing that covers, like, the entire scope of all he could do. But if I were to try to just kind of give an establishing moment, it would either be... I mean, I guess I'll go with the tag team of the year angle.
You know what? That was what I was going to say.
And that probably does cover the most different things.
Yeah, because you get Lance explaining, you get Lance in the middle, but the most important thing you get there is the look. And that's what I call it because, for those of you who haven't seen it, it'll be in our video podcast this week. Eddie Gilbert and Tommy Rich, the new Fabulous Ones, win Tag Team of the Year. Because it was in Memphis, the WFIA convention, because there's no way they would have won Tag Team of the Year for tagging up for, what, 2 months, 3 months?
How dare you say that?
Yeah, well, you know it's true. So, they win Tag Team of the Year.
But they're already broken up.
They're already broken up.
Because the voting was done in the spring.
So, Eddie comes out and accepts the award from Pete Lederberg and Howard Baum. And he gives a speech, and it's a very baby-faced speech, actually, about how he wishes the Fabulous Ones were still together. And then Tommy Rich comes out in a suit and just beats the crap out of Eddie, who bleeds and is bleeding all over the place. So then they come back from commercial, and now there's just bloody Eddie, not even standing up. You know, like leaning on the desk, like on his knees.
Yeah.
And, you know, Lance is there, and Lance is totally into it. Like, you watch Lance, and Lance is completely invested in this. And Eddie suckers Tommy out that he wants to make up, he wants them to be friends again. and Tommy Rich agrees, and they go to walk away together, arm in arm, the new Fabulous Ones reunited, and now you don't see them. Now the only thing on the camera is Lance, and Lance kind of, he like glances down for a second. I don't know if he looked at his watch
well,
or what.
Well, he starts throwing to the next segment.
And then at that point, off camera, Eddie attacks Tommy Rich after suckering him in and beats the crap out of him. But you get Lance's face. And he doesn't make a sound, but it's almost like if he did, it would have been... Like, it's just, he has this look of disappointment. And I don't know if any other commentator in the history of wrestling has ever been able to pull off the disappointment. Like, even the famous angle with Lawler and Austin Idol, Demente Negro. I guess Diamante Negro, it should be Diamond.
But they say Demente Negro.
They say Demente Negro, I know. But it should be Diamante Negro when, you know, Austin Idol as the Black Diamond, otherwise known as the Big House, which is always my favorite little tidbit thrown in there. He's also known as the Big House. he gets the award that was in Jerry Lawler's handwriting from Mexico for Wrestler of the Year, because Memphis Wrestling is on cable in Mexico, according to this. And he beats him, breaks it over Lawler's head, starts beating him up. Guys come out to break it up. And then Austin Idol pulls off the mask, and Lance Russell's just like, oh, I knew it. He doesn't say I knew it, but it's almost like that's where he was going. And it's just his reaction in the background makes it so much better. Of course, that's also the angle where he yells, Hector, tell him in Mexican to get out of here, which is what an immortal Lance Russell line.
And just, I feel like he's sort of underrated, though, as far as calling a match.
Oh, yeah, he's great at calling a match.
Yeah.
Because, again, he seems real. There's no pretense. You don't listen to Lance Russell and go, this is a guy trying to make me believe this is real. You listen to him and you go, this is a guy who's treating it like it's real.
Yeah, and it's just different types of stuff, too. Like, and whether it's getting over, like, the really big matches, or even something like how his commentary was on something like the, why am I forgetting names all of a sudden? Oh, Bill Dundee, Tony Charles match.
That's a great match, yeah.
Where, and I'm pretty sure this is genuinely what happened on TV. He's talking about, you know, this match happened in Jackson, Tennessee this past week, and it was such a treat that we want to show it to you. And I think that's legitimately what it was. He just thought that, you know, they taped it and he decided to show it on the regular show. That they had this really good, like, technical type match.
I always liked when I forget which Tupelo concession stand brawl it was, where all of a sudden he's like, watch out, Randy.
I think that's the first, the 79 one. Yeah, where he's telling Randy West that. Like, I'm not, and he has no idea how much of this they're going to use, and he's telling Randy to watch out as he goes down the stairs. And of course, another one of the immortal Lance Russell lines, mustard everywhere.
And then at some point in the late 80s, Lance got a flat top.
What?
His hair.
No, he didn't.
Yeah, it was like, it went from like being longish to like kind of like a little, what would you call it?
Not a flat top.
I mean, I'm not saying it's an exaggerated flat top, like flat top and Dick Tracy, but it was like a little bit of a flat top.
I'd have to review the film.
Lance Russell. I'm not going to put flat top because nothing will come up. Images. Okay, I guess it's not really a flat top. It's like it's an updated hairdo, I guess. In my mind, for some reason, I pictured him with a flat top right there.
You're saying flat top, and like, I mean, Lawler got got sort of a flat top when he lost the hair match to Idol.
Is there any look? He lost the hair match, so we can say that Lawler wasn't wearing a wig up to that point. Is there anyone in wrestling who looked like they were wearing a wig more than Jerry Lawler, who it turns out they weren't?
Vince.
I never thought Vince looked like he was wearing a wig.
You thought it was just that he liked to joke about. You always thought it was more just he liked to joke that he was wearing a wig. You never.
Well, that's the thing.
Looked like it.
Whose book was it where they said, you know, maybe it was Piper's, where he said, I started doing commentary with Vince after Ventura left, and all he wanted me to do is, he said, just, you know, make fun of my hair, call it a wig, make fun of me wearing a wig. So
someone else said that too. That for some reason he was just really into the heels pretending he had a wig, or whoever he was working with on commentary.
I'm guessing Ventura started that, and Vince liked it so much that he just continued with it.
Well, I guess he thought, too, that it made it seem like he had the most immaculate hair in the world. And if the heel's saying it, the heel's a liar, so the heel's wrong. That he's wearing a wig, so he's not wearing a wig. but it still reflects well on his hair that you think he's wearing.
No, come on. He wouldn't be that vain and insecure.
All right. Of course, another one of my favorite Lance Russell moments is the Renegades Rampage trivia contest with Eddie Gilbert and Missy Hyatt.
Oh, that's great. Yeah.
They were doing this trivia contest every week, and Missy is sitting in for Dave Brown for that show or whatever it was, or at least for part of the show. And Eddie's like, oh, I know the answer. I know the answer. And Lance is telling him, no, no, no. And then as right after Lance reads the question or he's giving the instructions or whatever, Eddie who was the manager of the interns or something?
Dr. Ken Ramey.
No, wrong accent. Dr. Ken Ramey?
I can't do Missy before her southern accent got fixed.
Because
that's what it was. WCW sent her away to get rid of her southern accent.
And it didn't really work anyway.
No. Why would anyone want to change her? I mean, this is one of those things. She was so effective from 85 to 87. In that role as that manager, she was so effective.
And in '88, whatever she did in Memphis and Continental too.
Yes, in '88 too. But then once they wanted her to be a babyface and they made her a commentator, they took away everything that made her great. It makes no sense.
That was weird. What was the? I guess was it Crockett made her an announcer because WWF wanted her as an announcer or an interviewer, even though that went terribly.
Yeah, WWF was good. Apparently, WWF wanted her and Eddie.
Yes.
According to Eddie, they wanted Eddie to replace Piper.
And I think Missy told me the same thing.
They wanted Eddie to replace Piper's pit.
Oh, I didn't know that part.
Yeah, that's what I had heard. They wanted Eddie to come up and replace Piper's pit. And again, that may not be true, but that's what I had heard. And that was Eddie's story, I believe.
And that makes sense, actually, because undersized heel, but great promo, etc.
I don't know if Missy would have been involved with that, but Missy was going to go up there with him. And the reason he decided not to is that's right when Watts gave him the book, which, you know, was right when Watts also sold the company. So, you know, timing wise, it may not have been the best move. But Missy goes up there, films a few Missy manners, and they're terrible.
Have you seen them, by the way?
I have. I've seen which one? Is it the Can-Am or Strike Force? I guess it would have been the Can-Am.
The Can-Am. There's Randy Savage, Honky Tonk Man. They're dreadful.
Yeah, but I mean, again, you're taking someone who's been effective, who's been a good promo for what she needed to be, and all of a sudden you're just saying, we're just taking you and we're changing everything that made you good. I mean, it's typical to the World Wrestling Federation at that time to do that, but...
But Crockett and Continental had used her as an announcer first.
Right, and... Well, first before Crockett, not before WWF.
That's right, because she was No, you're right. I'm wrong.
Yeah.
I'm thinking out of order for some reason. It was WWF, Crockett.
And Continental. I mean, that's Eddie doing that, because Eddie was booking. Yeah.
And she was still kind of a heel in Continental, right?
Kind of. I mean, she was total heel with Eddie in Memphis, which was, again, the last great Missy Hyatt stuff. But then she goes to WCW, and she's like this babyface manager with the Steiner brothers for no good reason.
Right.
And then she's just off TV for a little bit, which, again, a lot of that may have been just a political fight that Eddie was having at that time after he left the booking committee. And he was having a little bit of a feud with Ric Flair, and Missy got caught in the crossfire.
A little bit of a feud with Ric Flair.
Well, how would you summarize the feud? The problems, I should say.
I don't. Well, it went back 2 years, though. I don't know if I'd call that a little bit of a feud.
Yeah, I mean, I guess so. You know, I hadn't thought of it that way, that the problems with them on the booking committee started after the UWF buyout and those promos back and forth.
Well, you also have to remember that one of the things that led to Eddie losing the job on the booking committee was telling all the newsletter fans at WrestleWar the UWF rides again starting at WrestleWar.
Did he do that?
Yes.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
With
the idea that him and Jim Ross were booking and Ross and Hayes were hosting the main TV show, so that type of thing. And Sting was getting a bigger push, I guess. So that's part of it, too.
I mean, that reminds me of, what was it, in 19... What was it, 1990, when Lawler was going to go in a feud with Luger?
91, yeah.
And was it Eddie and Paulie went on Arezzi and Goodhart's radio show and said it? And it killed the deal?
No, it was... Eddie was scapegoated as having leaked it to Heyman, or one of them. I think it was when Heyman was first fired, before the Dangerous Alliance thing when he came back, because the official version was that they thought that Eddie leaked it to him.
No, that was the second time Heyman was fired, because he was fired in 89.
Did I say the first time? I meant when he was fired right before the Dangerous Alliance thing.
He was fired a lot.
He was fired from WCW 3 times, right?
Yeah. How much money did he get from that last lawsuit? We still don't know.
Enough to live off of for several years.
Yeah. Although, was he living in his parents' house when he did ECW?
I don't know.
I was one of those kids who got like Paul Heyman's number because it was listed and called him up. And like, you know, he would pretend to be his roommate. And like, you know, it was just ridiculous every time.
Did his roommate voice sound anything different from his regular voice?
No, it sounded just like Paul Lee. But, you know, why would you know, if you don't want to get phone calls, make your number private. You're famous, man.
But it wasn't even that. It was like Jericho said in his book, and other people have said that they'd call him and get his roommate.
I don't know. But Eddie and Paul, I mean, it was just those two were like always in trouble with each other up until they fell out.
Anything else about Lance, I guess, or should we move on?
I just, you know, you hear this kind of thing after someone dies, and hopefully Lance lives a long time, but I've never heard anyone say anything bad about him, other than Jerry Jarrett. I've never heard anyone say anything bad about Lance Russell.
And they've kind of made up anyway.
Yeah, and quite frankly, Jerry's probably wrong about his feelings about Lance Russell for all those years. And because, quite frankly, you could argue that Jarrett wouldn't have been successful in going out on his own in 77 without Lance Russell.
Absolutely not.
Yeah, I don't think there's any way he would have, because Lance was the key. First of all, the relationship with Dave Brown, who's the number one weather guy already there, and he was the key to getting WMC5, was Lance and Dave.
Yep.
So, and even more than Lawler, actually.
Well, I think it's having Lawler and Lance Russell. Once you had the two of them, and Dave, it's having Lawler, Lance, and Dave.
Yeah.
As a package.
Yeah. I mean, I think Lance, you could argue, though, was the most important part of that package.
Because of the behind-the-scenes stuff and everything. Yeah. Yeah.
He was a longtime respected program director and station manager in Memphis. He'd been very successful, well-known, well-liked, and he had Dave Brown as his understudy, and Dave Brown, at that point, was already the premier weather guy on TV.
The most popular news personality in Memphis.
Yeah.
By far.
So, and then I think the falling out is, correct me where I'm wrong, Bix, I know you know a lot about this stuff.
It's the 83 thing.
Yeah, where Lawler, I guess it all started where, and this will be in my 83 book, it all started where Jerry Jarrett got a new house in Hendersonville and invited some of the wrestlers to come up for like the grand opening ceremonies. And they realized, wow, this house is really nice. So that's where all the money's been going, into this fucking house. And then Lawler started getting mad because when he came over in 77, when he agreed to go with Jerry and not go with Nick Gulas, which killed Gulas in Memphis right away. I mean,
the promotional war
lasted a few months and then it was done. It was to be a partner, right, Bix?
Yeah.
And it just never happened. They never. Yeah.
Jared says it's just that they were so wrapped up in everything else that he just never ended up saying anything. So, and Lawler didn't, so I guess he didn't press the issue. But
so Lawler finally gets mad enough that he says, you know what, I'm not being treated like a partner, I'm going to do something. And Lawler had a better relationship with Lance Russell than Jerry. It was Lance who discovered Jerry Lawler.
Yep.
And they had that relationship, and Jerry told Lance what he was thinking, and he wanted to go off on his own and do something. And Lance was going to be with him. And
to hear Lance tell it, it was more Lawler asking him, if I do this, are you with me or are you with Jarrett? And Lance telling him he was with him. But if you hear Lance tell it, he did not reach out to any other TV stations or anything. He was just he just gave Lawler his word that he would go with him if he left.
Yeah. Now somewhere around this time, and this is something I'm researching to get the exacts on. Jerry Jarrett hears about it from Bill Dundee's wife. And Bill Dundee's wife hadn't even told Bill. Bill didn't was unaware of it. And there's a lot of political stuff happening there at that time between Dundee and Lawler. So Lawler is preparing for this, and now he's calling wrestlers from all over the place to come in and work for him. And Jarrett finally gets wind of it and has a meeting and settles it by making Lawler a full partner. I'm not sure if there was any back pay. You would think there should be, but I'm not sure if there was. But it causes Jerry Jarrett to have resentment for Lance Russell for doing this. And according to Jarrett, he cut Lance's pay greatly.
According to Lance, he did not, and he still has the pay stub somewhere to prove it.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't make sense that he would have and Lance would have put up with it or Lawler would have allowed that to happen. But that's Jerry's story. And that's why in 83, which again directly kind of leads to that talent exchange between Mid-South and Jarrett Lawler Promotions, all of a sudden in the middle of 83, you have more talent in Memphis than you've ever seen before.
Yeah, I love that. I love that photo of the first family during that period where it's like 20 guys.
I know that's one of my favorite photos ever, and it has to be like our show photo for one of these shows one of these days. It is maybe this one. It is probably the coolest picture ever because who's in it? It's Dream Machine, Jimmy Hart, Jim Cornette, Colossus of Death,
Apocalypse.
Apocalypse, Dennis Condrey.
Whoever Colossus's partner was, Norvell Austin. I'm trying to remember. Buddy Landell?
Buddy Landell. I don't know if Coco or Bobby were. I don't think they were in that one. But yeah, it's like one of the coolest pictures ever. Jim Cornette took it. He like set the timer and jumped in the picture.
And, but it just shows you how many wrestlers they had, and they also sent Dundee and some of the leftovers to Chattanooga for Ole's Georgia Satellite promotion.
All right, here's the picture. You ready? The Grapplers, Buddy Landell, The Assassins, Plowboy Frazier, Dennis Condrey, Porkchop Cash, Dream Machine, Colossus of Death, Apocalypse, Jim Cornette, Jimmy Hart, and Ken Patera. Like, what a cool picture this is.
Send me the picture on.
Oh, I will. I'm gonna make it my screensaver. And it's really cool. But yeah, that leads to in the summer of 83, there's all these problems, and they resolve it by having Dundee leave town and go to Chattanooga, where Ole, because Ole's going national with World Championship Wrestling, going into Ohio and
he doesn't have anyone to work that like Macon and Columbus and
Chattanooga.
Yeah.
And so they go over there and Dundee's the booker, and he brings the Fantastic Ones, an early incarnation of the Fantastics of Terry Taylor and Bobby Fulton, Ken Wayne under a mask as the Stray Cat looking like Tiger Mask, Norman Frederick Charles III, Carl Fergie
as King Carl Fergie.
Yeah. It's all so cheap, but it's really awesome. Frank Morrell, the Angel, Jerry Novaks, the Bounty Hunter. I feel like I'm missing one baby face and I can't remember who.
And of course Cornette's there as the lead heel manager.
It's the first time Cornette gets his face put in cake.
Yes. And all of the relevant stuff from the Chattanooga shows is on the first of the two Cornette rookie year DVD volumes. By the way,
most of it. I don't know. There were two tapes that went around, two full episodes in perfect quality in the late 90s that came from Ron West. He had found them in his attic.
But I mean, Cornette being the lead heel manager was all over the show. So
yeah,
there's only like there's maybe a Stray Cat match, obviously, that he wouldn't be involved with. But at least of the other stuff that was available, I don't remember really there being anything notable that's not on there.
And then at some point, Ole Anderson just came in, and I believe the exact words Cornette says is that Ole came in and said, "Don't do this anymore." And that was it. They closed down. Everyone went back to Memphis. But again, now Memphis has this giant roster, and Watts is looking for help, and he brings Lawler and Jarrett in to look at his shows. They see his shows, and their first reaction is, "Where are the blowjobs?" Because there were no women in the crowd. And then Watts comes to the Mid-South Coliseum in October, and he watches a show, and one of the first people that stands out to him is Jim Cornette annoying people at ringside. So he ends up making a deal where he takes Jim Cornette and the Midnight Express, who weren't even teaming at that time, Bobby Eaton and Dennis Condrey. He takes Terry Taylor. He takes who else is he taking out? Buddy Landell, I guess, would be in that first batch. Yeah. And the Rock and Roll Express, he makes the deal for them to come over. And Bill Dundee is his booker. And he gives up Masao Ito, Rick Rude,
Hacksaw Higgins,
Jim Neidhart, Hacksaw Higgins, the forgotten guy in that whole trade. And I think that may be it. Maybe I'm forgetting someone.
I feel like we might be forgetting one person. But as Cornette always says, the only time anyone ever got the better of Jerry Jarrett in a business deal.
Yeah. So I'm trying to think, how do we start on this from Lance Russell?
I don't know. So we want to talk about someone who also was in Memphis in 1983.
I was there. I slept with Memphis wrestler Black Shadow. I rooted him after I rooted for him.
What about Rough and Ready?
Rough and Ready? Memphis Vice were very kind. Okay.
What about Boss Winters?
Now you're just whipping out the bottom.
Is Boss Winters the only guy who ever whose only people he managed were a job guy tag team?
Maybe.
Is there anything else like Boss Winters in a major territory?
No. Memphis got away with – Memphis had great stuff, and then they had stuff you don't know how it got on the air or whose idea it was, but that's what makes it awesome.
Also, that Rough and Ready's names were Rough and Ready. They'd wrestle singles matches, and it would be Jerry Lawler and his opponent, Ready.
Oh, yeah.
Say what?
I was going to say, where'd you want to go, Mix?
Well, I think we were going to go to Stan Hansen.
Okay.
He's
on the line right now. No. Okay, go to Stan Hansen.
No. What, did you want me to moo for you and pretend to be Stan Hansen?
Can you? Let's see it.
No.
Yeah, exactly.
Stan Hansen's going to WWE Hall of Fame. And I guess we wanted to talk about that. Well, it's going to be twofold, because we realized we wanted to talk about it, and we realized that his book can be our book of the week. And I, for some reason, have not read this yet, but you have. But before we go over all that and talk about him, to check out the book of the week, the best way to do it is either click the link that's in the show description, or if you're going to Amazon, use tinyurl.com/605amazon, because that is our Amazon referral link. You don't pay anything extra, but we get a few percent sent our way, and it's a very nice way for you to support the show without doing anything that you might not already be doing otherwise. So I'll let you start with Stan Hansen too, since you've read the book and we're talking about the book too, and I haven't. So, go ahead.
Well, first, let me also add to what you just said. If you have anything in your shopping cart and you're going to use our referral code, take it out of the cart and put it back in. Because if you have something that's already in the cart and then you use the referral code, we don't get anything for it. Yes. But if you have something and then you put it in the in the shopping cart using our referral code, we'll get, you know, a few cents. It's really nothing. You think, like, when you hear, like, Steve Austin and people talking about it, that, like, oh, they're getting like a dollar per sale. You're getting pennies per sale. It's ridiculous. So, Steve Austin begging for pennies. What happened to that guy? Anyway.
I don't know. And that also includes the saved cart, by the way. So, if you keep something in your saved cart, you also have to take it out of that first and then add it back in after you use the referral link if you want to help out.
Yeah. So, I was surprised you hadn't read this book, Bix, because I really love it. I think it's really underrated for the reason that, like we're saying right now, you haven't read it. And it's an incredible book. It's by Scott Teal, our friend who was on the show previously, Crowbar Press. It's called The Last Outlaw, which I think was going to be the name of my book, The Last Outlaw. But anyway, it is an extraordinary book because it covers so many things, and Stan's very honest. Stan says stuff that other people – I know for a fact Bruno got uncomfortable because Stan in the book says that he was told when he broke Bruno's neck that the mafia were going to get him and that Bruno, like, told him to relax. And now Bruno denies it because, you know, Bruno doesn't know any mafia people, of course. I wanted to talk a little bit about
Bruno said that people went up, like, that mafia people contacted him after he broke his neck.
I hadn't heard that. I heard Bruno flatly deny that it
ever
happened.
Bruno had at least said he had been approached by guys, it was not like he knew them or anything.
I don't know. He was hanging out at Jilly's. I don't know who he knew and who he didn't know. Anyway, this book, you know, I guess to tie it into what we're discussing with him going into the WWF Hall of Fame, WWE Hall of Fame, you know, there's always that – he's like one of two guys, him and Brody, that you think of as being stars in the 80s in Japan who – what if they had had that program with Hogan?
Yes.
It would have been a natural fit. And, of course, Stan Hansen was in No Holds Barred. He was one of the top heels in that movie, one of the worst movies of all time.
But he has possibly the best scene in that movie.
Yes. Oh, I think he definitely has the best scene in that movie.
You've got a tiny wanger. You've got a tiny wanger, too. It ain't even worth it.
Was it tiny or teeny?
I think it's teeny.
Yeah, I think it was
got
teeny.
Got a teeny wanger. I have no idea what I sounded like just now.
I can tell you it wasn't Stan Hansen, but we'll figure out who it
is. So does that mean that he was going to try to have sex with them?
I'm not sure, because wasn't the girl with him in that movie his sister in the movie? Because she was then teased, like he told her, and then like the guy comes out of the bathroom and Stan Hansen's there with the girl and they're like teasing him. They're like, teeny, teeny.
It ain't even worth it?
Yeah, something. I don't know. Again, that movie is Vince McMahon and Hulk Hogan coked up in a hotel room the day before shooting, writing that whole movie over. So, allegedly.
Is the in the hotel room for 48 hours thing confirmed?
That's confirmed. I'm saying that I'm alleging that I think there was cocaine involved based on everything, based on the year, the script, both of them, you know, admitting to past drug use. I absolutely think that's exactly what that movie is. It's the cocaine delusions of two egomaniacs. But anyway, in the book The Last Outlaw, one of the interesting things is Stan talks about his relationship with Hogan. And they actually were very close in the early 80s when they were both touring New Japan together.
Well, they were the two top foreigners.
Yeah, and they were a tag team for a little while. And there's pictures of them in the book, like hanging out, just, you know, like arm around each other, chilling out. And they look really funny because, you know, when Stan's out of the ring, he's like wearing like a flannel shirt with giant glasses and just doesn't look like a wrestler. He looks like a, you know, like a cowboy or something. And Hogan's like all Hoganed up. it's like a buddy movie that should have happened.
Hogan with like the sunglasses that they look less tinted in part, and that's when he still had the hair on top of his head.
I think
probably
they called
wearing a T-shirt with the Ichiban symbol on it.
Yes, that's exactly it. And I think they call those glasses the Arezzi glasses. Okay. I think that's the official term. And they were very close to the point where Stan goes into detail in this book, and it's really neat. You know, him and Vince McMahon Sr. did not get along. They had a lot of problems. And when he came back to work in 81 for the WWF, Vince McMahon Sr. didn't book him, and he didn't call Vince McMahon to book him. It was actually New Japan who set that whole thing up. And they set it up under the agreement that Stan couldn't be pinned by anyone. And WWF various times tried to get him to go back on there. They tried to get him to do a job to Backlund. They even tried to get him to do a job to Bruno, and he refused. And he actually made the deal in 1980 because he said that him and Shinma had the meeting with the McMahons the day of the Shea Stadium show. And then they went over to the show and watched it. So, I mean, that's the thing. You know, with these Scott Teal books, these guys have information, and I feel Scott does a great job of cracking down on the exact specifics of timeline. Because another interesting thing in here is he made the deal to go to All Japan in June. And remember, he debuted in December at the end of the tag tournament. He made the deal in June, and then he still had three more tours of New Japan after he had already signed the contract with All Japan. Terry Funk called him up one day. He was upset. Him and Hogan one day were hanging out in New Japan, and all of a sudden Abdullah the Butcher walks in with a bunch of press. And they're like, what the hell? Because Abdullah was the top heel for Baba. And they're thinking, okay, if Abby's here now, one of us is going to be lost in the shuffle. Because Abby's not coming here to be like third in line or fourth in line, because Andre was there too. So they're both a little peeved. And then a few months later, or maybe even less than that, Terry Funk calls him up randomly. And it was the first time he had talked to Terry in a while. And he said, listen, would you be interested in talking to Baba? And Stan said, look, I would talk to him, but you should know I'm very happy with New Japan. They treat me good. I'm not looking at leaving. And Terry said, just talk to him. And Stan said, I'll do it under one condition, complete secrecy. We need a location we can meet. I don't want anyone knowing about it except me, you, and Baba. So they agree in June. Stan Hansen had a family reunion, and he agreed to meet with Terry and Baba at the Marriott at the Dallas airport, because he was going to be there. So Terry Funk's running late because he's at the funeral of Stanley Blackburn's son, I think Ray Blackburn. And Hansen gets there, and in the meeting is Baba, Mrs. Baba, and an executive from NTV. And he was shocked that Baba spoke perfect English. And he said usually Baba liked to have Joe Higuchi as his translator, but Baba didn't need him. Baba spoke perfect English.
You know what's interesting about that? for as different as Baba and Inoki are, that's one area where they're exactly the same.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, they both toured extensively in America in the early 60s.
Oh, yeah. No, but I'm just saying that they both would kayfabe everyone on it.
Yeah. Well, it's a good way to negotiate. You could always have the middle guy. You know, I'm surprised Vince hasn't pulled that yet. And they make a deal that he's going to come over there in December. And he still had three more tours of New Japan left. And as he was finishing up in December, right before, you know, days before he made the appearance at that classic Brody and Snuka against the Funk Brothers match at the end of the 81 Real World Tag Team Tournament, he told, I think, three people in New Japan. He confided in them. Andre the Giant, Pete Roberts, who was someone he really had a great relationship
with. Pete Roberts was one of his best friends in wrestling, yeah.
Yeah, and Hogan. He let Hogan know, too. And he told Hogan, look, if you ever want to come over, Baba would use you as a top single star. And at that time, Hogan had a lot of stuff going on. You know, he was just now starting with the AWA, and he didn't really see us making a move. But a lot of the heat between Hansen and McMahon, it stemmed from him not doing jobs when he came back in 81. But they agreed upon that, and then they tried to, you know, not bully him, but get him to renege on that. But also, he was one of the first wrestlers to not use an independent booker, not use a booker to go to Japan, because originally the Funks were booking him in Japan, and then when he went to work for Vince in 76, Vince took over and started booking him into All Japan, and he somehow got out of that and just said, look, I want to book myself. And Vince Sr. did not like that. And then there was another incident where a tournament was just starting, and they had all the wrestlers in the ring sign these like rubber balls and then throw them out into the crowd. You may have seen scenes of that before.
Yeah, I remember that, where at the start of each tournament,
yeah,
the fans throw the balls at the fans.
Well, jokingly, he told Vince Sr. he was going to throw it in his face because Vince Sr. was going to be in the ring to read a proclamation.
Right, because it was the probably the MSG Tag League or whatever.
Yes, that's actually exactly what it was. And Vince Sr. did not laugh. He did not sell it. He did not react because they already had heat. And then word got around. So when all the wrestlers are throwing the rubber balls in the crowd, Hansen throws his ball up in the air a few times and just catches it. And everyone's watching him now, and he throws it right above McMahon's head on purpose. But he said, again, Vince didn't flinch. He didn't move. He didn't smile, nothing. So there was like legitimate heat there for between those two guys. But him and Hogan had this relationship to the point where when he came to the WWF in 81, Hogan still had an apartment in New Haven, and Stan Hansen stayed there. That's where he stayed for that entire run. So, you know, the whole idea that Hansen would work a program with Hogan, you know, Hogan didn't like to be hit or hurt. So that's the only thing I could think that would have stopped it if it ever was negotiated.
Well, especially because Hansen, he couldn't even help it.
No, he's blind as a bat. But they were buddies. So, I mean, it would have worked. Like Brody, Hogan may have had trust issues with. I could see that. But Hansen and him got along great. And again, when Terry Gordy in 1990 refused to do the job to Hogan on that All Japan WWF Super Show at the Tokyo Dome, it was Hansen that jumped in at the last minute and willingly did the job and gave Hogan maybe his best match of that era.
You know the rest of that story, though, right?
What's the rest of the story?
Who convinced Gordy to walk out on doing a match?
Oh, I don't remember. Who was it?
Stan Hansen.
Was it? I didn't know that.
So he got to be the hero.
Oh, man. Oh, man. Well, this book is really good, Bix. And I actually, beyond the listeners getting it and checking it out, I definitely think it's one you would really like, because again, the details are incredible, and you get details like every problem he had with Vern. You also get him telling the stories that Hogan told him back then about things that happened, like when he was talking to Hogan after Hogan left in 83, and he gets Hogan's side of the story of like he left because he was upset with the merch money, he said, and about the whole confrontation he had backstage with Vern, where Vern tried to double leg him. And you get like all these really cool stories. And this is a guy who started with Bruiser Brody. They both had issues with promoters, Brody more than Hansen. So you get a lot of Bruiser Brody stuff. You get a lot of the dynamics of the Japan wrestling wars of the 80s, where, you know, again, the day that Hansen was negotiating with Baba in June of 81, Baba told him, he goes, I'm also negotiating with Tiger Jeet Singh, you should know. So, I mean, it was like, you know, All Japan and New Japan were just raiding each other of both Gaijin and Japanese wrestlers back and forth just for almost the whole decade. I I really, really highly endorse this book, The Last Outlaw by Stan Hansen with Scott Teal. Of course, you can use our link on Amazon, 605, what is it, tinyurl.com/605Amazon.
Yep.
I'm not sure if both books are up, but definitely the Kindle version is up there.
Kindle version's definitely up there.
And if you get it from Crowbar Press, crowbarpress.com from Scott Teal, just let him know you heard about it here on the show because he's a friend of ours, and I want to let him know that some of our listeners are supporting his fine work.
Yeah. One of the things, I mean, obviously because of No Holds Barred, you could tell they must have still been friends, but it makes me think of how in Bret Hart's book, he talks about how when they did the first shows, WWF shows in England, that for like union reasons or whatever, it was some local entertainment law or whatever, they had to have local wrestlers on the card. So that's why if you look at those results, there's six-man tags where it's like Mark Rocco, Dave Finley, and someone else against Dusty Wolf and two other guys.
Yeah.
And Rocco was kind of talking to people about how he had been good friends with Hogan in Japan and was looking forward to seeing him. And then when Hogan came in, he had no idea who Mark Rocco was. But it was they legitimately had been friendly with had been friends in Japan, and Rocco was crushed by it.
That's like the story of, you know, Eddie Murphy on his first season of Saturday Night Live. Gilbert Gottfried was on there, and Gilbert only lasted 1 year, and Eddie went from being a featured player to the star of the show for 4 years. And when he recorded Beverly Hills, when he filmed Beverly Hills Cop 2 in, he either filmed it in 86 or early 87, I'm not sure, but it came out in 87, I think. Gilbert Gottfried has a memorable scene in there where it's great, where he's like this accountant that Eddie Murphy's trying to hustle out of something. And Gilbert says that he went over to Eddie. He's like, "Hey, Eddie, it's good to see you." Eddie had no idea who he was. And they had been in like, you know, skits together in 1980 on SNL. And he just didn't remember him at all.
And this is not that much later. The price of fame.
This book is really, Bix, like I said, this book is really good because, you know, Hansen is arguably the biggest foreign star in the history of Japanese wrestling.
Yep. How much does he cover the 90s?
He covers everything. Kobashi's one of his favorite opponents of all time.
Excellent.
This is an excellent book. It covers everything from the beginning to the end. It's really thorough. And like I said, I'm surprised that more people haven't jumped on this book. But it's a really, really, really great book. Really great book.
I will jump on it now then.
Okay.
Well, and I will use tinyurl.com/605Amazon.
I once jumped on it on Little Beaver in Australia. Bix, tell me about Dutch Mantel.
No, I'm not going to.
I want the belt.
You know who I'd love to hear a ring rat story about?
Abdullah the
Your
Butcher!
Mamba, the Jungle Savage!
Do that again, I talked over you.
Your Mamba! The Jungle Savage!
No, your Mamba!
My Mamba?
I can't wait to get Mark Alina on the show. That's going to be like the greatest moment in the history of 605.
I can't say if this is accurate, but I hope it is.
You will see him in the coming week!
Oh! Do you think it'll be a good episode, Bix? How would the episode
totally
be?
Totally awesome!
Totally awesome. All right. I can't wait to get Mark Alleen on the show and then have Mark Alleen talk to his sound bites. That's exactly what we're going to do. But like I said, it really is in the works. I am working as hard as I can trying to get this to happen. Mark Alleen here on 605, the Super Podcast. What will be a banner episode.
I will tell you more about him later.
Oh, thank you, Mark Alleen. And, you know, Bix, we've heard from Nikita Koloff. We've heard from Mark Alleen. There's one person we haven't heard from this week, and I'm wondering, what did Larry Nelson think when he heard the Sue the Shooter story? An extra one for old time's sake. Maybe we got to get Derek Dukes on the show, too, now that I think about it.
We can also ask him about doing a job to Mark Gastineau.
You know, a couple of people hit us up, Bix, and they said that the match never happened. Instead, it was changed to the winner paints the loser yellow because of racial issues. Or not racial issues, but because of the controversy about the incredibly racist stipulations.
Jesus. Ah, Vern.
Yeah.
Who was booking then? Was it Wahoo?
It may have been Wahoo, because Wahoo was there, I think, at the time.
I don't know. It's the AWA, so maybe it was Vern's idea.
Yeah.
Because, as you know, black wrestlers can't get over in that territory, he says.
Yeah, well, I think now it's time for one of our features here this week. Bix and I had a conversation with an old friend of mine, and I mean that. I was actually at his son's bar mitzvah. Ron Scholar, former promoter of the IWC, the man who brought AAA to the United States. Bix, I feel like he doesn't get his proper due.
No, he doesn't, and I don't really know why. I mean, he did at the time.
He did at the time.
Oh, no.
Yeah, but now, like, whenever I read in the Observer about, like, those shows, it's always like, you know, AAA did this, AAA did this. It's never like, no, they had a guy who was an intelligent business guy who had serious promoters on his side doing it, utilizing AAA. Because if there's one thing we've learned about AAA through the years, they're a disorganized mess, with or without Pena. They can't really do many things on their own without it being a disorganized mess.
No.
So Ron Scholar was the exact opposite, and you're about to hear part one of our talk with him. Part two will be next week. And something you should know about this is we talk a little bit at the beginning for the first few minutes about his background, and I thought that was important because what Ron was able to achieve in professional wrestling was because of his connections in the music industry. So I wanted to make sure this doesn't just start with, tell us about the first show you promoted. I thought it would be interesting and important for us to know a little bit about his background and how he ended up becoming a promoter in professional wrestling and what he had done in the music industry before that time. So anything else you want to add to this, Bix?
Yeah, I kind of would have loved for you to do like Feinstein-esque versions of questions that, like, what are your memories of Mascara Sagrada? What are your memories of...
No. Well, I do catch myself sometimes. You know, I try to ask good questions, but I also try to... My thing is I try to ask questions that I think are going to produce a good answer.
Oh, yeah.
And then I try to always be ready with a follow-up. But I do find myself sometimes saying, like, what do you tell us your memories of this? And I'm always like, ugh. You know?
Those were some real good memories, bro.
Yeah, that famous Feinstein interview with Jimmy Snuka where, what are your memories of Don Morocco? Good memories. Good memories, brother. But yeah, so I catch myself sometimes saying the word memories. And just because Rob Feinstein does such awful stuff, I always think like, ugh, I don't want anyone to think this is a lazy interview like that, but I don't think anyone does. Just my own personal, thing I catch myself with. But with that said, here's part one of our talk with Ron Scholar of the IWC. While Vince McMahon has dominated live event promotion of professional wrestling since 1984, there was a brief period of time in the early to mid-90s, where there was another promoter who was the most successful live event promoter in the United States. And that man was Ron Scholar. Before I introduce Ron, I want to read a quick quote here from Conan in a 1994 Torch Talk, with Wade Keller. And this sums it up. My respects to Ron Scholar, because he had this vision, this idea to bring wrestling to the U.S. on a large scale from Mexico, knowing that it was on cable. He had a dream, and it worked. And joining us today, joining me and Bix here on the Super Podcast, is my old friend Ron Scholar. Ron, how are you today?
I'm good, thank you. That's a nice introduction. I didn't know that Conan said that. Hi, Brian. Hi, Bix.
So, Ron, before we get going with your history with Mexican wrestling and other things, tell me, what are your earliest memories of professional wrestling? When did you start attending professional wrestling, and where did you start attending professional wrestling?
It's funny. I mean, I remember watching it as a kid on TV in New York. It was on Saturday afternoons. It was on, I don't remember what time it was, or was it either late morning or early afternoon, and it was the WWWF, and it was on either before or after the Rifleman, you know, reruns. And I remember, you know, watching it, and it was, I said, like, what is this? It was fascinating. And Bruno Sammartino was the champion. And, you had Killer Kowalski, Gorilla Monsoon, Dr. Jerry Graham, Argentina Apollo, all these guys. And I remember, watching this stuff, and as I must have been like, 10 or 11, I was watching it with my cousin one time who was from Massachusetts, was staying with us, and he said, he was a few years older than me, and he said, I bet I can predict who wins every match. And I said, no way. What are you talking about? And he would say, okay, this match, this is who's going to win. This is who's going to win. This, you know, I'm like, well, what are you talking about? How could you say that? I mean, how could you say that Klondike Bill or Prince Nero or any of these guys, you know, who I didn't realize were jobbers, are going to lose? He's bigger, he's heavier, he looks stronger, he's going to do this. And sure enough, every match, my cousin was right. So I knew that, you know, that's weird. Either he's really, got some ESP going here, or, you know, that there's something else happening. But it was fascinating, and I enjoyed watching it. And it was something where you could suspend your disbelief. And then I remember, you know, my father took me to a couple of matches. You know, I got a little bit older. I remember he tried to take me to Madison Square Garden to see San Martino against Baba, but I was too young. And I don't know if you had to be 14 or whatever
14.
It was at the time.
Yes.
How old?
14.
14. I must have been like 12 or something, or 11, 12 maybe. And they wouldn't let me in because of that, which I think is ridiculous. But I did go to a show at the Island Garden Arena at the time. I saw San Martino against Baron Cicluna, and I went to a show at Sunnyside Gardens where I saw Antonino Rocca and his partner Johnny Walker, who then became later Mr. Wrestling too, I think, against the Von Hess brothers. And Lenny Montana was there, who was Luca Brasi from The Godfather. There's just some really kind of great, you know, cool memories of that. And, I look back on those days and, I liked it. That's fond memories.
You know, obviously when you would later become involved as a promoter in professional wrestling, one of the things you were able to do is use your connections in the music business to really propel the company. And I know you started young in the music business. You started interviewing rock acts when you were a teenager, I believe. Is that correct?
Yeah. I had a kind of interesting left of center, you know, childhood and, adolescence. And I was a friend of mine and I were putting out an underground magazine in junior high school. And from there, I started, you know, writing record reviews for some of the, you know, national music publications. And being in New York, there were a lot of rock shows that came by, and I would do interviews with people. I reached the height of my profession at the age of 17 when I interviewed John Lennon and Yoko Ono. Wow. And, then I went to college after that and basically, stopped the whole, you know, journalism thing. But I was fortunate. I got to interview, you know, Jerry Garcia of the Grateful Dead, John and Yoko for 2 days, the various, you know, rock stars at the time. And, you know, I met Frank Zappa. I met a lot of people. And, you know, they were great, great moments.
So you would go to school and you would become a lawyer. And, you know,
in between then, I went up to Boston. I was going to Emerson College. And I formed, you know, a rock band. I was writing songs, and I would send these demo tapes, you know, to record producers and managers and stuff, anyone I thought that might be interested. And I got a call from Mike Appel, who was an up-and-coming, you know, record producer and manager at the time, who had Bruce Springsteen. And, you know, everything I thought about myself, he thought was the opposite. Like, I thought that I was a really good lyricist, but that I had a really, you know, terrible voice and was not a good musician. And he said, you know, I really like your voice. It's a really interesting voice. In fact, I'd like you to record some songs that he wrote, because Mike used to be a songwriter for, you know, David Cassidy and the Partridge Family and stuff, you know, a million.
He was in the Balloon Farm.
He was in the Balloon Farm, right? An underground group, right. A Question of Temperature, right? That was their...
Correct.
So-called
yes.
Hit. Yeah, Mike's a good guy, and I represent him now. He's still a friend. And he said, you know, but your lyrics don't make any sense. And I thought about it. I said, I guess, yeah, maybe it doesn't. And I wasn't even on drugs. But it was like stream of consciousness stuff. So anyway, so when I graduated, I really didn't know what I wanted to do. Mike gave me a job working for him, like, you know, in his office as an assistant. And I learned the business. I worked there for a year. I met his lawyer, Jules Kurz, and then I decided, okay, well, entertainment law, that's something I can do, and we'll, you know, open several doors. So I did that, and I never deviated, and I made many sacrifices, you know, to accomplish that. I took a job in the music industry for exactly half the money that I would have made working for a law firm, you know, doing negligence work, which, you know, I had no interest in doing. So I actually took literally half of what I would have gotten paid, which still wasn't that much, you know, even if I took the other job. And my mother and my, you know, girlfriend at the time thought I had gone crazy. But, you know, I think you have to do what you like. Or as Joseph Campbell says, follow your bliss. And that's what I've done. I think if you do something that you enjoy and you're fortunate enough to be able to do that, things will fall into place.
When your name first started popping up in wrestling newsletters in the early 90s, the one act and the one record company that were most often applied to your name was Public Enemy and Lethal Records. Before we go forward with the wrestling stuff, tell us a little bit about Public Enemy and Lethal Records.
Well, what happened was I was working. My job was as an in-house lawyer, business affairs, what have you, for a company called PPX. Which owned by a guy named Ed Chalpin. And Ed had, you know, years before discovered Jimi Hendrix and, you know, worked with, you know, various people and made a lot of money from Hendrix through lawsuits, basically, and worked with Jimmy Cliff and, you know, a lot of people. And I was fortunate to get a job, you know, working for him. He's a very difficult person. I remember one time I left and came back 2 years later when he asked me, and he had gone through 9 different attorneys in 2 years because he's a very, very difficult guy. But that was okay because it toughened me up. And I've always gotten along, you know, pretty well with difficult people because I guess I was willing to take more pain to get to where I wanted to go than other people were. And I guess it's really about how much you're willing to put up with.
Yeah.
And when I was there, you know, I had an open door. And I let, you know, people come up and talk to me if they had something that was interesting. And when I came back to PPX for the second stint, I, you know, made a deal with Ed. And I said, look, I'll give you 30 hours a week. I will, you know, do whatever you need. Give me an office, a secretary, and anything above that, let me, you know, do my own thing and try to build a practice. And he said, okay. And he gave, you know, a weekly salary, weekly meaning W-E-E-K and W-E-A-K. At the same time, and one of the groups that came to me was Public Enemy, but it was not really Public Enemy. It was just Chuck D at that time, and Hank Shockley, who was, you know, his partner as a producer at that time, and they really wanted to form a company called Rhythm Method, and I couldn't do that without Ed because I was working under his roof, so I dragged him kicking and screaming into it. And we formed a company, and we launched not just Public Enemy, but Tribe Called Quest, Jungle Brothers, worked with DJ Red Alert, De La Soul, even Queen Latifah, you know, early on. So it was, you know, there was just a lot going on, and I was, you know, really fortunate to be in the right place at the right time. And that's pretty much what happened.
Yeah, those are the same.
I opened my own office.
Those are the centerpieces of New York hip hop in the late 80s.
Yeah, late 80s, early 90s. Yeah. Now,
so,
Lethal Records was something that came later after the Mexican wrestling. A distributor in Chicago offered me a chance to have my own label. So we put that together for a while, and then I changed and moved over to Polygram and then to Warner's. And we had moderate success with it. You know, nothing big, but a couple of things that did okay. But again, that was like in between. The wrestling was like right in between that. And the Lethal Records came afterwards, and Rhythm Method Enterprises, Public Enemy, and all that was before that.
So correct me where I'm wrong, but in 1992, you're listening to John Arezzi's Pro Wrestling Spotlight, and you like what you hear, and you get in touch with him?
Well, we started promoting, I think, from 93 to 95.
Right, but I'm talking about before you started promoting.
Yeah, right. So initially what happened was, I guess I was listening to the radio, and they have this wrestling thing. I was always kind of fascinated with professional wrestling. I mean, I would get the magazine sometimes, and I would see all these things, like these people that I had never seen wrestling, but they were these great pictures with these guys like bleeding to death on the cover, you know, the Sheik and Bruiser and Crusher and Bull Curry and all these you know, psychos and stuff. What?
Bobby Heenan.
Yeah, or Bobby Heenan, the manager. Yeah, and it was just some cool stuff. I was always fascinated with it, and I would still occasionally go to matches at the Garden, you know, when I was in college and stuff like that, when I was in New York. And, you know, I always, you know, kind of was interested in it. Then I kind of lost track of it for a while. And I somehow I was listening to the radio, and I heard a Rezzy show, and I would listen. It was fascinating to me because they were really talking about they were stripping away the veneer of professional wrestling, and they were talking about what was really going on with it, and that it's, you know, a work and all of that. And it was, I mean, I always kind of knew that, but it was always kind of interesting to me because it was pretty much a hidden world. Yet I liked it, and I liked the idea of suspending your disbelief, and, you know, it and having an escape and getting involved in that. And I respect the talent of the wrestlers and the managers and what they have to go through, because it's a grueling thing. I understand why they don't like the expression fake, because they get hurt quite a bit, probably more than any other, you know, professional athletes do. So I have a lot of respect for that. And when I was listening to a Rezzy's show, which at that time, I think John Russo, was it John Russo? Was his
Vince
first name?
Russo.
Vince Russo was on with him too. And then they had the falling out. And I started listening to him right like a week or two before they had the falling out is when I was first listening to them. And I think I called him up, you know, just to, you know, whatever, to say hello, what have you. I liked the show, you know, when they were off the air. And I remember Russo called me back once, you know, didn't have a great rapport with him, but I liked John. And then what happened was I would be just like channel surfing maybe 6 months later, and I would see Galavision, whatever, and I would see these Mexican wrestlers. I was like, can I curse on your show?
Oh, yes, feel free.
Okay, I don't have to, though. And I would say, what is going on? You know, or I would have said, what the fuck is this? And I said, these are guys that, you know, they were lighter, they were smaller, they were more acrobatic, they wore masks, and it was like a whole new world to me. And I really, you know, I really wasn't interested in the Hulk Hogan era, because to me, I mean, Hulk Hogan, I met him once, he was a nice guy, and I respect, you know, what he's accomplished. But that whole era, Hulk Hogan, Ultimate Warrior, those are like, you know, cartoon characters to me. It wasn't something that, you know, was of great interest to me. I like Ric Flair, though. And I remember watching Galavision, I said, like, whoa, you know, this is great. These acrobatic moves, these crazy, death-defying moves, like somebody jumping off a high diving board, but there's no water there. I was like, wow, this is fascinating. This is great. This is exciting. So I called John Arezzi, and I said, do you, because he was my one contact in the wrestling world at that point, and I said, what is this? Do you know who this is? What is going on? Is anybody promoting this? What's happening? And he, you know, said, yeah, he knew about it, and Antonio Pena was the guy, and that, you know, he could put me in touch with him if he wanted to. He didn't know him, but he knew how to reach him. So I said, yeah, I'm interested. So I called my friend Daryl Brooks. And Daryl works with somebody, Carol Kirkendall, Carol and Daryl, CD Enterprises. And I knew them from the music industry because they were partners with a client of mine, Herbie Lovebug, Herbie Azor, who produced and wrote songs for Salt and Pepper and various, you know, successful hip-hop artists, Kid and Play, you know, a lot of people who were successful at the time. And Carol and Daryl were from Washington, D.C., and they were like the major promoters there of all of the urban events. And they also nationally promoted. And they promoted shows for, you know, Luther Vandross and Vogue, Prince, Def Comedy Jam, you know, Fresh Fest, all that kind of stuff. And they were well respected, and they had a lot of juice with the arenas. So I called Daryl and I said, you know, this is something, you know, you're going to think I'm crazy, but check this out. And, you know, he was open-minded to it, and he didn't know anything about Lucha Libre, Mexican wrestling, but he watched it, and he thought it, he had some mild interest in it. So through a resi, we contacted Antonio Pena, and he invited us to Mexico to see Triple Mania, which was, you know, their, you know, version, I guess, of WrestleMania, and it was in a bull ring in Mexico City, and it was sold out. They had 48,000 people. So I remember, you know, going down there, Carol, and not Carol, Daryl Brooks, myself, we had an interpreter. I'm not sure if Arezzi went with us at that time or not. I think he didn't make that trip. But Daryl and myself and the interpreter went down there, and, you know, we met Pena and Conan, and, you know, we were there. For this amazing event, we brought Jake the Snake Roberts with us because that was, you know, to set up an angle. And Jake the Snake, you know, ran into the ring during the Conan versus Sin Cara match, and with Mascarita Sagrada also. And he ran and he picked up Mascarita Sagrada, the mini midget, and, you know, threw him down and antagonized the crowd. And we had a run for our lives. My shoe came off as we were trying to escape, you know, and from where we were sitting, because they saw that Jake was sitting near us. And fortunately, Daryl got my shoe back. And that was the beginning of it all.
So that's April of 1993, and you go down there.
And we went to Pena, took us to a restaurant slash bar in Mexico City. I remember it was kind of weird because on television, everybody was watching car crashes. They had something on. I mean, I don't know whether it was like from the Indianapolis 500 or NASCAR or whatever, you know, Daytona, whatever. And they were just watching car crashes, which is, you know, it's pretty sick. But that's, everybody was like watching that. It was like, oh, my God, look at that. Look at that. Look at that. You know,
well, I mean, that's Mexican TV. It's just very different culturally. I mean, and you still have it. I think it's toned down, at least as far as
maybe,
the stands.
Maybe we should build a wall, come to think of it.
I think it's been toned down a little as far as the Spanish-speaking TV in the U.S., but
just
I mean,
kidding.
I know. You think about, like, even just with wrestling, though, in Mexico, you know.
I mean, I've always had people sitting around just watching, you know, auto crashes, like, right. You know, people getting killed, and that's like, you know, that's entertainment.
Well, I mean, you know, CMLL aired Oro dying on TV, you know, when Pentagon overdosed and nearly died in the ring, AAA aired that. That's the culture.
I didn't know that.
Yes.
I guess that TV footage is at a premium.
So Ron, you're down there in April of 93 for Triple Mania, and Pena takes you guys out, you and Daryl. Who else is with you guys at this restaurant, and how does the conversation start?
His assistant, the guy named Chucho, was there. It might have been somebody else from his company. I think my ex-wife was with me at the time. Daryl.
None of the workers.
We just talked about it, and we said we want to start running, and Daryl suggested the sports arena in Los Angeles. And, you know, up till then, they were just doing shows, like, in gyms and places. And before that, of course, was the Olympic Auditorium. But that wasn't Pena. But that was, you know, who was running wrestling in Los Angeles, which was not Lucha Libre, but, you know, Gordman and Goliath and stuff like that from Mexico. And we really had a vision to take it, you know, to the next level and to promote Mexican wrestling in the same arenas, in the same stadiums that, you know, that the Clippers played in, or the Lakers, or, you know, where the Knicks or the Rangers, you know, would be playing, or where Bruce Springsteen would be playing, or Prince. So that was the vision, to take it, you know, as far as it could go. And the first show that we did, La Revancha, was at the Sports Arena, and they had never had a Lucha Libre event there before. and we promoted that, put a lot of money into it, a lot of advertising, not one word in English, by the way. All of the advertising was in Spanish, whether it was radio advertising, TV advertising, print advertising. And I remember, you know, the show was on a Saturday. I remember as of Friday afternoon, I talked to the box office. I said, well, how many tickets did you sell? And they said, well, we've sold 6,000 tickets. I said, 6,000 tickets? You know, and the place held 17,000. I said, so what do you, you know, what do you predict? No, it was 6,500 tickets. It was 6,500 tickets. I said, what do you predict? He said, well, if this is a, like a WWE event, or I think at that time it was WWF, they said, I think we'd probably do about 8,000, 8,500 people. I said, and I'm thinking like, yeah, that might be enough to break even, you know. All right, not bad for the first time. We'll see. Well, the next morning, Saturday morning, I got a call, and they said that there were lines all around the stadium, you know, in the morning for people buying tickets. And I didn't realize that for a Mexican event that it's, you know, it's really a same-day buy. And they kept buying all day long to the point where we sold out all 17,000 seats, then an extra 1,000 to go 1,000 above capacity. So we had 18,000, and then we had 8,000 people turned away. And I was like, this just, you know, blew me away. I was, you know, incredibly happy. And I remember the evening of the show, I go in there, and this may be funny, and I'm talking to Manuel Escalante, who was the lawyer for AAA and, you know, the parent company, and he was educated at UCLA, so he was, you know, he was Mexican, but he was very Americanized as well. And he was telling me how happy he was, and I was very happy, and I was just, like, beaming. And then I look over at Daryl Brooks, and he looks like, you know, he's just having a miserable time. He has a miserable expression on his face. So, and I go over to him, and I go, you know, what's the matter? He goes, just leave me alone. Would you just leave me alone, please? Just leave me alone. I'm like, yeah, what's the matter with him? So then Gerald Scott, who was like Daryl's, you know, number one guy, these are all guys from the R&B, hip-hop, you know, music business. And yeah. Gerald said to me, he says, you don't understand how a promoter thinks. I said, what do you mean? He says, well, you are happy. You're looking at this like, wow, isn't this amazing? Isn't this great? We sold 18,000, you know, seats. We got like a, you know, $250,000 house. This is the first time we ran it. Isn't this great? I hit a home run, you know, and look at all that. And Daryl is looking at it like, okay, we sold this out, but we just turned away 8,000 people. I got 8,000 motherfuckers with money in their pockets, and I ain't got a second show.
Yeah. And there was a big traffic jam.
Right,
the
but
show.
There can't be a second show for wrestling, just like there can't be a second show for a boxing match, you
right.
know, and we're going to let's wrestle again. I mean, yeah, if this was, you know, Luther Vandross or something that he was familiar with and they, you know, they sold out, yeah, let's add a second show. But you can't do that with this. So I'm still very happy about that.
Now, going back a second, you mentioned Chucho. That was actually Antonio Pena's partner. And it's not speaking out of turn because this was something that went public when Chucho passed away a few years ago. I mean, yet that was Pena's longtime partner.
When you say partner, well, okay.
Romantic so, partner, yeah.
You mean so Pena was gay, I know, yeah.
Yeah, no, I'm just explaining to for those who are listening, yeah, that the Chucho was his romantic partner, you know, was his partner.
I didn't know that at
yeah.
the time. I didn't know that Pena was gay, which is fine. I was not aware of that. And Chucho was much younger than him. I think he introduced him as his nephew.
They might not have always been a couple. I know he worked in the office for a long time, though.
Because he was a lot younger. Yeah. But, hey, look, you know, to each their own. And, you know, Pena was a beautiful guy. He was a great guy. And he was, to me, the Walt Disney of wrestling.
Yeah, I mean, with Chucho passed, too. I mean, he was as beloved
what did
as
Chucho
Pena
die
was,
of?
I don't recall. It was a few years ago. I don't really remember. But, I mean, he was
I didn't
as,
know
like,
that. That's,
yeah.
that's too bad. You know, it seems like, you know, people talk about the music business and how people die young, but it's got nothing on wrestling. I mean, when I hear about people who were professional wrestlers or people involved in the wrestling business, you know, they have such a short lifespan. It's really tragic.
Yeah, you know, speaking of music, you know, you're now around Pena. Conan's his top star, and I'm sure you're around Conan a bunch. Did you ever talk with either of them about music? Did they ever express to you what they were into?
I wonder what you're trying to get at with this.
I know what you're trying to get. Conan, I like Conan. He's a really interesting guy, and he's got a great vocabulary, and he was always interested in music, of course. I remember in New York when he was here one time, and he was trying to get the new album by Snoop Dogg, and they didn't have it yet. So he would go to every, you know, at that time we had record stores, Tower Records or, you know, Virgin or whatever. He goes, do you have the new Snoop Doggy Dogg album? You know, I can't imitate him like I used to, but he kept asking Snoop Doggy Dogg, he would say, and nobody had it, but I'm sure he helped drum up a demand. But we talked about music all the time, and we talked about, you know, he liked Prince and he liked Earth, Wind & Fire. And I remember, you know, he said Earth, Wind & Fire, I think, was his favorite group. And he said, there's only one word to describe their music, and that word is elegant.
Maurice elegant. White just passed away. Yeah, elegant.
Maurice Earth, White, yeah. But he at least, you know, made it to an older age, you know, unlike a lot of people that I knew, like Art Barr and Eddie Guerrero and Louis Spicoli.
Well, we'll definitely get to them shortly. Let me ask you this. You know, you're dealing with Peña regularly, and like I said, Conan is his top star and is the biggest star in Mexico at that time. La Revancha was a three-way match between Conan, Jake Roberts, and Cien Caras, you know, coming months after that Triple Mania match, which was, I believe, career versus career, Cien Caras versus Conan, which Jake, right, of course, cost Conan the match. But when do you start do you start right away having regular communication with Conan? Is Conan someone who wants to be very involved in what's going on with the company?
Yes, of course. I mean, Conan is he even said this too. He said, you know, I'm a loquacious fellow. That's another thing he said. And you know, he likes to talk. And he would be calling Meltzer all the time, and he'd be calling me, and he'd probably Keller, and if he knew you, he'd be calling you, and he'd just be calling everybody and being very much involved. And he was a guy that wanted to be involved in, you know, all the politics and everything else, and you know, just took an interest in everything. And he said to me that the show that we ran in L.A., the first one, La Revancha, was very historic. He was very happy about it, and he just had a very good take on it, a very interesting take, and I enjoyed working with him. You know, I mean, we were friendly. There was a falling out at one point, but, you know, that didn't last long. You know, I always respect Conan. I always like him, and he's really one of the most interesting and entertaining people I've ever met.
Yeah, you know, Conan's the top star there at that time, and Cien Caras is the top heel. You also have Perro Aguayo, and you have a young Rey Mysterio Jr. You know, yeah. What were the relationships you had with any of the other talent? And also, when you first start watching AAA on Galavision, who are the specific wrestlers that stood out to you?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, first of all, let me just say that at Triple Mania that I went to in Mexico City, the wrestler that stood out to me the most actually was La Parca. He had a match against Liz Mark, and that was a fantastic match. And I thought that match, that really stood out to me. Other than that, I mean, watching it on Galavision and in person, I mean, Conan certainly, although Conan's style wasn't really a Lucha Libre style per se. He was agile, but he had more of an American style, I think, you know, as opposed to like a Rey Mysterio Jr., who was, you know, fantastic, or heavy metal. And the guys who stood out to me, you know, would be really the Flyers, the guys who would do these death-defying, you know, leaps off the top rope, and, you know, the crazy, like, suicidal, homicidal moves that they would do. You know, Rey Mysterio Jr., heavy metal, let's see, a lot of them.
And, you know, Rey Mysterio, when you first see him without his mask, what are you thinking?
I thought he was a kid at the time. I mean, he was pretty young. We're talking Rey Mysterio Jr. And yeah. I remember talking to him in the lobby of the Mondrian Hotel, where we were all staying at the time in Los Angeles. And I mean, I didn't even know who he was at first. And then I realized it, and he was there with his girlfriend, and he was, he looked, I don't know how old he was in real life, but he looked like 17.
And, you know, you mentioned Conan would call the various newsletters. When did you first start getting the Wrestling Observer or the Wrestling Torch or any of the other publications that were covering AAA and your promotion, the IWC?
When they started comping me. Sending it to me. I guess when we started promoting right around, I guess, 93.
And what did you think? I mean, you know, you're someone from the music industry. You've seen many trade publications.
I thought it was fascinating. I thought I liked the Observer. I can see why it could become, you know, addictive to people to, you know, to read that, because, you know, Meltzer was somebody who, and I'm sure still is, who was totally obsessed, you know, with wrestling and immersed in it. And, I mean, he lives for that. I think that was his... the main thing in his life, and he was very driven and very devoted, and you know, I liked reading it. I thought it was very interesting. That being said, you know, he could only print what people told him, basically, or what he saw for himself, and I think that it was very easy, you know, in some ways to swerve him, because somebody would call him up and tell him something, and if he trusted them, he would print it, and, you know, a lot of times it wasn't true. Like, for example, they'd be running shows at the Juan de la Barrera gym in Mexico City, and it was probably Conan that was giving him the information. Oh, every week sold out, 10,500 people, 10,500 people, 10,500 people. Well, the Juan de la Barrera gym was a training facility for the Olympics, for swimming, you know, which is really what that is. And it couldn't hold more than 3,000 to 3,500 people. So if they're saying 10,500 people, you know, I mean, yeah, maybe if you multiply it by three.
But Ron, going back, so now you're actively running. The name of your organization is the IWC. How do you come to that?
Because they wouldn't let me use IWS, which is the International Wrestling Syndicate, which is what I really wanted. And they said, oh, syndicate, you can't say that. That's like drug cartel or something, or you know, mob or something like that, which is why I wanted to use it. I thought it was kind of cool and funny. and they wouldn't let me use that. So we came up with IWC, which sounded like World Boxing Council or something like that. So it was kind of innocuous. It wasn't my first choice.
I mean, there was no thought into just running the shows as AAA. You wanted your own promotional.
Yeah, because
outfit.
We were not AAA. AAA was owned by, was it Televisa?
Yes.
Yeah. And it was owned by Televisa, and Peña didn't want it that way either, because that was owned by Televisa, and we wanted to have something for ourselves.
So around this time,
The Televisa was very uncooperative. They owned the wrestling company, but they really didn't care about it. They really treated it, you know, like the redheaded stepchild, and they couldn't care less. I remember we had a meeting with the son of the guy who owned the whole thing, and he was interested in talking to Gary Juster because it was Turner Broadcasting, but he couldn't have cared less about the wrestling. I felt like a potted plant in that room.
Yeah, and, you know, let me ask you this. So you go down in April for Triple Mania, and by August you're already running La Revancha, you know, a record-setting house in Los Angeles at the Sports Arena. So, right. I mean, things happen pretty quickly. Things move very fast.
It moved very fast because the next night, against my wishes, Carol and Daryl, you know, had scheduled a show in San Diego, and I said, why do you want to do that? Why? They said, well, it's a routing thing. They're still thinking like music industry, which it's not. Wrestling is more like the circus than the movie industry. And they were saying, oh, we have them here. We've got, you know, the visas. We've got everything. You know, let's do this, you know. And we ended up losing money in San Diego. I mean, we still were ahead. We didn't lose that much that it was a loss for the whole weekend, but it cut into the profits we made the night before. What they didn't realize is that, you know, San Diego is very different than Los Angeles, and it's very close to Tijuana. So it was just a really bad idea.
Yeah, and, you know, around this time, you were still, you know, obviously you're based out of New York. Your office is in Manhattan, and
yeah,
you're still...
I went to Los Angeles you know,
of course.
5-6 times a year, Mexico City, you know, 3-4 times a year. And it was racking up. I was racking up the frequent flyer miles in those days.
Yeah, I'm sure. But,
thank
you know,
God, now I don't have to, you know, travel like that. I really hate traveling.
In New York, you're still appearing somewhat regularly on John Arezzi's show because John, you know, was a real booster on the air for the IWC.
Well, he was involved with us. He had a small piece of the company. We cut him in.
Oh, I actually did not know that.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay, so he had a vested interest in promoting it on the air in New York.
Yeah, I guess so. You know, I mean, but for a while. Then at the end, I don't know what happened, but we worked something out. But he was involved with us, you know, at one point.
So, and what did Pena, what did he think of John Arezzi?
He liked him. In fact, Pena wanted to create a wrestling character about John Arezzi. Do you know John Arezzi first started out as he wanted to be a wrestler?
Yeah, he actually wrestled in a handicap match against Dusty Rhodes in 78 or 79.
Peter Maivia, right?
Yes, that was a tag match with Peter Maivia, yes.
Right, and he was there, you know, and I think he had never wrestled before, and Gorilla Monsoon asked, are you a heel or a face? And he said, heel. So they put him in the ring against, I don't know how many matches he actually had, but when he got hit by Peter Maivia, I think it was, you know, he felt he had a concussion, you know, on his head. After, I don't know if it was a real concussion or just his head hurt, but I think later they came over like, are you okay, whatever, you know. But he really came in without any training as far as I knew it. So, you know, he had guts to do that, either that or, you know, he had, you know, taken leave of his senses. But he did actually get into the ring. And Vince Jr. was the announcer. I'd love to see a copy of that match. Anyway, not to digress too much.
I'll send it to you after the show because it's on YouTube.
You actually have it?
It's on YouTube, yes.
My God. Well, anyway, so what was I saying? Oh, and so Pena came up with an idea to create a Lucha Libre wrestler named Papucho. And Papucho is like, it's like a slang term, I guess. It's, I don't think it's an actual word. It means like something like cutie pie, adorable one, something like that. And he was going to put Pena in a three-way, you know, in a tag team. And there were six-man tag team matches primarily. And he was going to team him with Latin Lover and somebody else, like two of like the best-looking guys there. And then Papucho was going to come out dressed like Cupid. That was the idea. And it would have been a great idea. And John, you know, was considering it, but he felt that, you know, it was going to take too much of a toll on him physically, so he wasn't really, he never really pursued it. But that was Pena's idea. I like John Arezzi, you know, I miss him. And, you know, he was always nice to me and stuff and kind of, you know, helped me get back into this world. You know, he was my contact. So, yeah, Papucho would have been a real, real interesting concept. I would have loved to have seen that happen at least for one match.
So my big lasting memory from this interview we did with Ron Scholar is the end of part one that you just heard there, which is Papucho.
Papucho! There's the biggest what if in wrestling history.
What if John Arezzi got booked in on the IWC AAA shows teaming with Heavy Metal and Latin Lover as Papucho?
You know, there are those two matches, one of them's on YouTube, of Arezzi in late 70s WWF. Doing jobs. Maybe it may have still been the WWWF. Him and Silvano Sosa against Dusty Rhodes, which is a disaster. And then there's the tag match he had with, I forget exactly what the match was, but Peter Maivia and Jay Strongbow, I think, were the opponents. And the last thing anyone would say or think when watching those matches is, God, we should wait until this guy ages another 15 years, gains 150 pounds, and then make him a luchador. Can you imagine John Arezzi in Lucha Libre?
I can try.
Oh. As Cutie Pie. That's the funniest thing.
Which was Louis Spicoli's nickname in Herb Abrams' UWF.
And by the way, we're going to be doing something on Herb Abrams' UWF soon. I know a lot of people have hit us up and asked us.
Well, what date did he pass away? Because we're approaching the 20th anniversary of his passing.
Oh, you know, I'm not sure off the top of my head. I posted it to Twitter a little while ago. Let me see if I can find it. I want to say it was April, maybe May.
So it's coming up. Okay. We got to do that then because He was special. And one thing, because I...
What? That sounds so insincere when you say that, even though it's true. He was special.
Well, cause a while back I downloaded the Blackjack Brawl, and I was looking because I didn't necessarily want to watch the whole show, and I guess now I need to find the whole "Let's hear it for the Jews" thing.
He never says it on the air.
Oh, it was during a break.
Yeah, he never said it on the air. I feel like it's become this urban myth that Herb Abrams said it on the Sports Channel showing. Because it was like in the Observer, and now people are like, "Oh, I remember when he did it." I'm almost like 100% sure he never actually said it on the air. He died on July 24th, 1996.
Okay,
so we have some time to really do it justice. But
we should do a contest and give away baby oil.
Yeah, because someone just hit me up and they said, "Do you remember that there was an angle where Paul Orndorff was, I guess, attacked or involved? I don't remember exactly the specifics." By Colonel DeBeers, and he was bleeding all over. And Colonel DeBeers got on the mic and did an interview at the end with Herb Abrams, and he said that the fans should watch out because Paul Orndorff has AIDS.
What?
Yeah, we got to find that footage somehow. Another great Colonel DeBeers moment. Boy, that Wiskowski really went over the top, didn't he?
And so. Before, although I'm more partial to the Mega Maharishi than I am to Colonel DeBeers.
Yeah, well, you know.
Say what you will about him, he certainly read the papers.
Yeah. Yeah, so but yeah, John Arezzi, that's another guy we're going to hopefully have on the show one of these days soon. I know he has a lot of Dr. Michelino stories, so that alone might be worth
it. Everyone does. And now also, did you know that Colonel DeBeers was part of possibly the greatest Lucha Libre Trios team in history, and by greatest I mean worst and weirdest?
No, which one?
On the AAA and Pro Wrestling USA combined show in Oregon, the Tonya Harding show.
Right.
There's a match where I think it's Rey Mysterio and the Pope Brothers against Psicosis, Colonel DeBeers, and Ryu Mago.
What?
Yeah.
Oh, man. I used to joke with my friend Masahori about Ryu Mago. About how terrible he was, and then
he actually was good at one point.
Yeah. Well, I'm talking like '95, and then like he had that Tokyo when they had that World Pro Wrestling or Weekly Pro Wrestling Tokyo Dome show. What was it? It was like Ryu Mago versus the Space Aliens or something.
Yes, one of the various Jewish Space Aliens. That
yeah, the one with the Star of David. Yeah,
Japanese. You know, there were like tons of those, right? There were like different breeds of Jewish aliens in the small Japanese Indies.
Oh, I thought you meant in life, in Smash Japanese Indie. No, I didn't know that.
Yes, there was I'm trying to think who. So he wrestled, I think, Uchu Majin Silver, Majin Silver X. And I can never figure out if Uchu actually meant Jew.
Should we do a Passover show or something? Or something just about the great Jews in wrestling? I mean, you and I are both Jewish, before anyone gets offended that we're
so
talking.
We can honor Ron Scholar.
Ron Scholar we can honor. And
The Malenkos.
Randy Savage's mother was Jewish.
Kane.
Izzy Slapowitz.
Kane.
Is Ken Patera Jewish?
Goldberg. Why do you say that?
Because I read somewhere online recently that Ken Patera was Jewish and I'd never heard it before.
I feel like I might have heard that before. I don't know if that's true. Missy Hyatt.
Goldberg. Missy Hyatt. That's an interesting one. She converted. Paul Heyman is like a given, I guess. But who else?
Oh, I'm forgetting some. Joe Koff.
Abe Jacobs?
Yes, Abe Kiwi World Jacobs. I'm forgetting.
Is Dick Steinborn Jewish?
Maybe.
I think he may be.
Now, moving on to someone who's not Jewish.
Yeah, I'm going to let you finish that sentence. I'm going to let you finish that sentence.
We've got our Dentist of the Week now, which is part two of our talk with Donnie B of Twin Brothers with Nova and NWA New Jersey and Phoenix Championship Wrestling and Ring of Honor fame. And I think this, if for people, I'm guessing they're, that if anyone's listening, they like the Dentist of the Week stuff and all that.
Oh, they loved last week's. About. Last week may have been our most popular one.
But if by some chance you're someone who's been skipping this and you're more familiar with the early 2000s, early to mid-2000s indies and all that, you'll appreciate this one more because he talks quite a bit about the Backseat Boys, Trent Acid, and Johnny Cashmere, especially Trent Acid.
If you're someone who's skipping the Dennis of the Week and listening to the show, just PBDS yourself off the nearest bridge, please. I don't want you to listen to the
yourself.
Show.
That's it.
That's, yeah. I don't want you listening to the show. If you skip the Dennis of the Week, I don't want you listening. Just do it. Jump.
But less jump, more dive.
Yeah. Dive onto a phony pirate that won't catch you.
So Donnie B.
Donnie B, Don Boosie, part two, like I said, part one of the interview with him was very, very popular. People loved it. The Tom Cassati story and various other stories about hotel hijinks and just Dennis. So part two, like Bick said, we'll talk about Donnie's involvement with the Backseat Boys, which is something that meant a lot to him, as well as more Dennis. So with that, it's time for the Dennis of the Week with Donnie B. You know, Donnie, Dennis never wanted to be involved in our hotel hijinks, but he always wanted to know what we were doing just because he found it so funny. And I remember in Philadelphia in 98 for the Eddie Gilbert Memorial Show, for some reason, one of us had water balloons and we decided let's start a water balloon war in the hotel. And it was me, you, Mark, Steve Carino, a few other people, probably Lupus if I had to guess. And a few things I remember about that. One was there was some kind of cheerleading or gymnastics competition. So at like 3 a.m. when we're running around water ballooning, there are just girls doing like flips down the hall everywhere you turn. And the other thing was this hotel in Philly had like a giant lobby, a giant atrium. And each floor of the hotel could look down on the lobby. And there was a giant grand piano down there. And someone threw a water balloon and it went over and it hit the grand piano. And sitting next to the piano was Sid, Psycho Sid. And, you know, that was when security got hip to us doing this. And they stopped us. We were in an elevator, the door closed. And then all of a sudden it opened and it was a security guard standing there. And he took all of our water balloons except for Carino because he hid it in his shirt. And he acted like he didn't have one and he got away with it. So there was only one water balloon left. So the
I remember that. I think it was Mark who dropped it on the piano next to Sid, and he would gladly take credit for it. But that was, like you just said, man, how are you going to replace those memories, dude? And yeah, Dennis knew. He didn't want to know what we were doing when we did it, but he would love to hear the stories. And I think what excited Dennis the most is that although Mark was his son, Mark was also his best friend and his partner. And yes. To hear that his son and his best friend was out there with, like, one of the boys and having fun and being accepted by all of us, even though he was a kid, I think that's what warmed it. Dennis all the time used to tell me, hey, man, thanks for looking out for Mark. Thanks for including him. Like, all the time, dude. Like, he fucking loved his son. I know all fathers do, but Dennis really, really loved Mark.
No, they were definitely closer than most father-son relationships. They, like you said, they were best friends without question. And that brings me actually to Dave Prazak was on the show recently. It may have been last week, depending on when we edit this into the show. And he talked about the NWA New Jersey invasion led by Dennis and Mark into IWA Mid-South run by Ian Rotten. And we put the video up of the first appearance of Dennis and Mark. And I know you were there for both, including the famous Lady Diana, Princess Diana, whatever you want to call her story. So what are your recollections of those trips to Louisville, Kentucky?
They were fun, man. Like, I remember Dennis calling me and saying, hey, man, we got this thing to do with Ian. He wants to bring us in, get a little pop, and we'll bring, like, some of his guys up here, like Bullpen and him and Mondo and stuff. And so, or Madman Pondo. And we were like, all right, let's give it a shot. So we, you know, all piled into a car and drove down there, drove to Ian's. The first time I think we drove or we flew, I can't remember which it was, but we flew once and drove once. And I just remember being in the back before we went out. And the one with the cheese, when he threw all the cheese, saying this cheese was for the rats in the audience, holy shit, man. I thought he was going to get killed. But that paled in comparison to what happened when we went out with the Princess Diana gimmick. Now, you got to understand, this was right after she died. And I literally, there's got to be a tape of this somewhere. I was less than 5 feet away from him when this happened. And he had a magazine, like from the Star magazine or something, a front cover of Princess Diana. And he's holding it in his hand. And I said, what are you going to do with that? He goes, oh, brother, we're going to bring it out. We're going to bring it out. We're going to talk about Diana. And I'm like, oh, my God, he's going to go out there and heal her. She just died. Like, what the fuck? And I'm like, Dennis, we can't go too nuts. You know, there was some lines we can't cross. And he's like, I know, brother. It'll be okay. Swear to God, they start the show. They want to do a 10 bell for her. And I think, like, on bell 7 or 8 or something, all of a sudden, and I'm standing right next to him. I had no idea he was going to do it. You hear, fuck that bitch. And I'm like, what the shit? So we walk out. We get about halfway down the aisle, and he takes the picture and just rips at us. And he goes, that's right, I said it. Fuck that bitch, and throws the picture in the air. And I was involved in some decent skirmishes over my years of people trying to get to us and get heat. That was the worst. There was literally, I'll never forget, there was an old woman in the front row, and she had, it was like telephone, like up on a telephone cable, a telephone wire, a copper wire that had been braided down, and it had big lag bolts, like three of them, and she made like a homemade cat of nine tails out of this brass. Oh, yeah, the fans had like shit in their hands, and this old woman was trying to whip Dennis with it, and she had to be in her 70s. And I just remember thinking, like, holy shit, there's an old woman with a homemade cat of nine tails trying to whip Dennis. And I'm trying to, like, avoid it, but at the same time, I'm trying to push Dennis right into it so he would get bumped by it because I thought it was funny. But they got so much fucking heat on us. I think we went in the ring, cut a little promo, and then the water was just getting too hot in the pot. So we kind of just skedaddled to the back and laid low.
And your That's brother cute,
man.
Moved.
That was it.
And your brother moved to this lovely locale.
Yeah, he went down there and just took it by storm, kicked ass, and you know, went on to do the Simon Dean gimmick and all that. And you know, that's one of the things, though. The Southern fans, they still believed and they enjoyed the business and they were passionate. Completely different than the Northeast or the West Coast fans. And that's, you got to know your, when you're in different territories in the country, you got to know the kind of crowd. The shit you would do up here isn't necessarily going to get over in Alabama. You know, if they see two guys go in the ring for 45 minutes with scientific holds, they're going to shit on it. But if you go out there and turn around and say, you redneck, shut the fuck up, they're going to go nuts. So it's just, that was one of the things, especially as a manager, I had to know what part of the country I was going to, where I was working, and what my crowd was going to be like.
You know, we've asked every one of our guests so far with the Dennis of the Week just if they had any funny stories of things that Dennis did around them or the things that they remember. You know, just outside of everything we've already talked about, what are some of your funny Dennis moments and Dennis memories?
The time when after one of the shows, he's on the warpath because somebody – so we went to one of the diners after the show and somebody ordered something – but didn't pay or didn't leave enough money, and all of a sudden Dennis was like legitimately madder than I've ever seen him, saying, I'm going to kill this motherfucker. I'm going to beat this guy to death. Finally I say, who? And he goes, Sal Petrilla Jr. And if anybody remembered Sal Petrilla Jr., Sal Petrilla was like the most non-offensive, like he was mentally challenged, like doughy, like helpless, mentally ill man that just like came to all the shows, and he was like a buddy of Ralph Soda's or something. I just remember looking at Dennis like, and I had to hold him back because he legitimately wanted to go beat this man up in the parking lot because Sal like didn't leave an extra $5 or something on his on his dinner bill. That one sticks out to me right off the top of my head. But the thing about Dennis is every single time I talked to him, was around him, or worked to him was funny. Or some kind of memory, or it was never dull. That's the thing about Dennis. Like, and all of us will say the same thing. Dennis is the only guy I ever knew that could literally hand you a stick of dynamite that was about to explode, and you would have a smile on your face. And by, this guy's great. Even though he was about to fuck you or screw you over, you wouldn't care. You'd be like, man, this guy's great. That was the magic of Dennis.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we talk about Dennis, and we've talked about some of the characters around his show, like Tom Cassati, and we talked about the Billy Reel incident. Who are some of the other either talent or characters you remember being around Dennis's shows?
Oh, the Billy Reels, the Ralph Sotos, the Boogie Woogie Brown came in one time for Kentner. Everybody, man. El Lazard, like you said. All those guys, Trent Acid, Johnny, everybody was a character in their own right. Everybody was like some kind of character. And, you know, he had these flavor of the month guys who would just come in and want to sell some tickets for Dennis, and I'd have to incorporate them into the show. And so that was a problem sometimes, too. Just Dennis would literally – I'd have a whole show ready to go, like, on a Thursday for that Saturday, and Dennis would call me at, like, 3 o'clock. I would be heading to the show on Saturday. And he'd be like, "Hey, man, instead of 7 matches, now we got to have 9, and the tag match we want to do, we got to put this guy in there." And I'd be like, "Oh, my God." So I'd be like – as soon as I got to the building – like 2 or 3 o'clock, I'd have to go in the corner, start rewriting shit, and then this guy sold so many tickets, or he wanted to, or he was going to get Dennis another show, so he had to go over, like fucking, what's that clown's name that ran CCW?
Zandig, that was where I first saw him, was dressed like the Ultimate Warrior. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and I don't know, we had beef over the years ago. I don't even know if I have no idea if he's alive or dead, I have no idea. But, I remember he was one. He'll lie. If he's still alive, he'd probably lie and say he didn't. But he would sell a shitload of tickets.
Yes, he did. I remember.
We got to put him up. We got to put him over. And I'd be like, okay. So Zandig here, Zan Warrior, would go out to the ring, and he'd hit his music, and he'd come out. He'd sell about 100 fucking tickets sometimes. But yet, when he came out, there was no fucking pop. So we'd be like, wait a minute, who the fuck is... Then we figured it out. He was buying the tickets himself. He had to be, just so he could get on the shows. Because the pop didn't equal the ticket sales. I mean, if you have an indie crowd of 500 people, and you've sold 50 to 75 of those tickets, when you come out, there should be a pretty good goddamn pop. But no, there would be no pop, and we'd be like, what? And then John would go in there, blow up, and trip over his own feet, and you know, that would be that. And then I guess the CZW thing, he did that. I don't even know. I have no idea if, like I said, if he's alive or still doing that, but God bless him.
Yeah, he sold CZW a while back.
Oh, did he? Yeah, that's right. When I did the memorial thing for Trent Acid a few years ago, I met the new kid at DJ Jekyll. What was his name?
DJ Hyde.
I was close.
Yeah, you were close.
DJ Jekyll.
Nice. Yeah, he was cool. That guy was cool. But whatever, the CZW stuff was never my cup of tea. Some of the kids from there were cool. Rick Blade was awesome. Brian Logan, the ref, was cool. Of course, Johnny and Trent, those guys, they were all cool. But the rest of them, whatever.
Well, real quickly, I know that after you were after you had managed Rick Ratchet and after you had done your babyface commissioner gimmick, you did a lot of stuff with Trent Acid and Johnny Cashmere. And what are your memories about that time and that team?
They're phenomenal, man. I mean, it's the easiest way for me to say it. I had come up with an idea that after Ratchet kind of wanted to get out of the business, I still wanted to manage, and I wanted to really concentrate on creation of gimmicks and teams and stuff. And I said, you know what? The boy band thing was hot. I said, I want to come up with a boy band. And originally it was going to be 3 people. And Billy Real was actually going to be one of them. I actually was going to pitch it to him. There was another guy, his name was Wife Beater. I have no idea what his real name was.
There were two Wife Beaters. Is it now because there was Chris Hero? There was Chris Hero and the CZ. Okay, so it was the CZW one. If he was jacked,
it was the CZW kid. He was big. He was good looking. I was gonna have him as like the muscle, Billy Real, and I was contemplating using a Trent intro. And it was gonna be Trent. And Trent Acid I knew forever since he was literally like 12 or 13 years old, and I always wanted to do something with him because he was a hell of a worker, and he was got some size to him, and he was coming around, and Dennis was using him. So I said to him, listen, I got this idea. I'm going to put you at the forefront as the workhorse. Billy Real will be like the heat magnet, and I need a third guy. And he pitched Wife Beater to me. And it was in, Paulsboro. I think that show, one of the Paulsboro shows, Wife Beater comes up to me, and it was right after a CZW show, and Wife Beater's head looked like it had been attacked by a weed whacker. And his whole face was cut up and his head was cut up. And I was like, I can't sell this guy like as a sex symbol when his face looks like it got attacked by Freddy, who was trying to scratch an itch. That's what it fucking looked like. It was all cut up. So I said, oh, okay. And then Johnny Cashmere just happened to be there. And I had never met Johnny. And Trent introduced me to him. And I said, huh, stand next to Trent for a minute. So I'm kind of looking at both of them. I'm like, we might have something here. So that night I put Johnny out at the ring with Trent. And I said, you know what? Billy at that time, he was kind of annoying me because he was getting all gimmicked up and stuff and just being a clown and getting in trouble. So while I was kind of interested in him, at the same time, I think I was kind of looking for an excuse not to use him. So I went to Dennis and I said, hey, I got this idea. I want to put these two kids together as a team based on a boy band. And Dennis was like, yeah, cool, let's do it. I didn't have the name yet. I was driving home that night, and Backstreet Boys, You Want It That Way, was on the radio. And I remember saying to myself, man, this fucking song is awesome if we had a cool name. And out of nowhere, like it was fucking from the heavens, it just hit me. I said, these guys, I'm going to call them the Backseat Boys, because they like to, you know, fool around with chicks and shit in the back seat of their cars. That's where it came from. So I called Johnny and I told him, and Trent, I said, listen, I got this idea. I'll get matching outfits. You're going to come out to this song, and I'm going to call you guys the Backseat Boys. And he was like, I love it. And then, you know, I used them for a while, and I didn't put myself in the act at that point. That came later on when they wanted to start getting booked to other places. And Johnny was like the business end and, the brains of the group. Not that Trent was, not smart, but Trent was the fucking worker. Johnny was kind of the business end of it. And then I realized that these guys needed a bigger megaphone, a bigger mouthpiece to really get them out there a little more. So I started pushing them wherever I could. And then I said, fuck it. People would say, well, why don't you just come with them? And then we just turned it into a three-man act, with stuff like our triple super kick, our triple power bomb and all that shit. And it literally was probably, me and Ratchet was special in one way, but me, Johnny, and Trent, for me personally on a professional level, was my most satisfying stuff because of the fun I had with those guys. It was just, I felt like a big brother to them, and I looked out for them, and I just loved them. I still love Johnny this day. I love Trent. And it just, I'm a better person for having done that with them, without a doubt.
You know, Donnie, something we had talked about previously here on the show, and also I released a video that I made for those shows, and it was quite popular with some people, especially people who were around our scene back then. And I know David Bixen's fan here really is a big fan of it, is the Saga of Sex Appeal Ronnie Steele. And it was something that me and Mark Hozel had way too much fun with when it was actually happening. And Bix, you wanted to ask Donnie a little bit about that, didn't you?
Well, yeah. So, I guess we went over the basics and the whole thing's on YouTube. But what can you add as far as your perspective of that whole thing going down? Your memories in general of one Sex Appeal Ronnie Steele?
Let me tell you guys something right now. Sex Appeal Ronnie Steele was very important to Donnie B and PCW, and I'm going to tell you this story right now. I had first met him, I think it was at that Point show, or the show we had right before that, and somehow Dapper Johnny and Gino had found him, or he sniffed around wanting to get on the show. I don't even think he was trained. And they took him into the fold, and at first I couldn't understand why. I was like, what is this guy, what the fuck is this? What does he have to offer? He's like, kind of like mentally ill or weird or something. So I didn't pay him any thoughts. And then I kept seeing him come around. Even in that Point show, they put him in the battle royal, so I knew something was up. So one day after one of the shows, he's coming out to his car, and I started bullshitting when it was like the first time I really sat and talked to him. And it turned out that good old Ronnie Steele actually turned out to be a pretty big wig in the world of Comcast cable. And
what?
Television cable in Monmouth and Ocean County and most of half of the southern part of New Jersey. He was very high up there as an executive in the cable world.
Oh, my God.
So I said, really? And he said to me, because at the time I said, I might be doing my own show. I was asking him about getting me some commercials or getting me a good rate on commercials on Comcast for my shows that I was going to start doing. And he said, dude, I'll do you one better. If you can somehow produce a television show every week, I'll get it on public access for you for free. And I'll get you the editing, whatever you need. I was like, what? He goes, yeah, dude, because I took a liking to him and I was nice to him. So I said, okay. I kind of called his bluff on it. When I started doing Phoenix, I called him. I said, listen, man, is that offer still hold? But let me backtrack. When I told him all that about, I was interested, I said to him, listen, this only works if you don't fucking tell a soul that we're going to do this, and if anybody else wants you to do something, let me know. And at that point, I had started breaking away from Dapper and Gino, and Dennis was in on it too. And Dennis had told Ronnie Steele, don't help Dapper and Gino, fuck them, just help Donnie. So Sex Appeal Ronnie Steele called me and said, hey, we're good to go, we can do this show. And at the same time, Joe Panzerino was calling this kid left and right because he wouldn't call him back anymore. Ronnie Steele wouldn't call Dapper back. So Dapper was calling him, leaving him all these messages saying, I know you're helping Donnie, don't help him, fuck him, like healing the shit out of me. And Ronnie Steele would call me and play me the messages. So man, I started telling Ronnie Steele to come around and, when you know, making him part of Phoenix. And then when we did the first couple shows, my right-hand guy, Mark Cannamalaccio, me and Cannon, we produced the first couple episodes. We gave it to Ronnie Steele, who then gave it to Comcast, and that's how we got Firebird TV on the air for almost a year. And then I just, you know, I kind of didn't really have the time to keep it going, but that Firebird TV and our show on Comcast in Monmouth and Ocean County, and I think part of Atlantic County too, was completely because of Ronnie Steele. 100%.
I am stupefied right now.
He was like, dude, I remember the first, when I went to drop off the Masters for the first time, for the first month of shows, I said, you know, whatever, I can't remember his real name, but I said his real name. I said,
Bob.
I'm here for him.
His
and
real
I'm
name
thinking,
was Bob.
Like, that's it. And I thought for sure they were going to, like, say, get the fuck out of here or whatever. They were like, oh, yeah, Bob told us you were coming. Like, it was legit. Like, he was a real bona fide executive. Like, he really was. So I couldn't believe it. So here, I gave them my tapes, and then that was on – first tapes I gave them were on a Monday. That Wednesday at 8 o'clock, I happened to be in a – I went – my crew, we all went for, like, a celebration of it to the Applebee's in the Toms River Ocean County Mall. I walk in. I asked them to turn on Channel 23, and boom. At 7:55, we turned it on, and at 8:00 on the clock – there was the intro to Phoenix Championship Wrestling, and we watched it.
Wow, ain't that
and it was
something.
Fucking awesome, man. That's up there as one of my greatest men. And I remember calling everybody afterwards and be like, oh, my God, this is incredible. But that was awesome, dude. And I called Bob, too, and just thanked him. And, you know, we had a good relationship, dude. I have no idea what happened to him, you know, after I got out of the business. But he was cool. I have no heat with him.
Yeah, very nice guy. Very nice guy.
Yeah, he was cool. He was a clown, and he was a goof, and... you know, haha, the video was funny and all that shit, but he was one of those harmless goofs.
Yes.
Like, he didn't walk around saying, Donnie B and Dennis are assholes, I should get the belt. Like, I mean, he didn't do that shit. He just showed up, and whatever we could do with him, he was thankful for, and I never minded those kind of people. They didn't bother me. It was these jerk-offs who, if you didn't book them, they badmouth you to everybody, and but when they saw you, they shook your hand, or they'd show up when you told them not to, or they try to get themselves booked on a show, or after you booked them, they'd call you and say, well, I could still do your show, but so-and-so booked me for the same night for double the money. Like, all these little tricks that they would try, dude. I couldn't take it anymore.
Well, moving back to Dennis before we wrap things up.
Sure.
Are there any other funny occurrences or, you know, really good stories you can remember from your times around Dennis's promotion?
If I sat down and really thought about it, I'm sure I could bang out a few, but just another one off the top of my head real quick. It was like Dennis had this weird thing, especially in the last couple of years that he was with us. He would just call. He had no conception of time, so he would just call at the weirdest hours of the night, 1 a.m., 2 a.m.
Yes, I remember that.
And I'd pick up and be like, hello? Like thinking, if I call you at 2 in the morning, you'd think, oh, my God, who died? Or there's some kind of tragedy. I'd pick up and go, hello? And Dennis would be like, yo, man, what are you doing? And I'd be like, I'm trying to sleep, bro. What are you doing? He's like, oh, the show next month. Well, what do you think of doing this? And I'd be like, I'll call you tomorrow, dude. That kind of shit. But the one night, it's got to be 3 o'clock in the morning, and my phone's ringing. I had the old flip phone, the old cell phone, a piece of shit. So I'm looking at it, and the screen was cracked, and I can't read the number. I'm like, who the fuck is calling me at 3 o'clock in the morning? So I open the phone. Hello? Hey, dude, what are you doing? And I'm like, what's up, Dennis? And I have a good friend of mine, his name is Chris, and Chris had long hair at the time and a full black beard the whole bit. And Dennis says to me, hey, man, what's your friend Chris up to? And I'm like, he's an accountant. Listen, you think we could get him on some shows? And this is at 3 o'clock in the morning. I said, for what? He's not a worker. Oh, listen, man, I had this great idea. He has long hair and a beard. We'll put him out there in a white robe, and he could just come to the ring, and this way we can put on the posters, appearing tonight, J.C., meaning Jesus Christ. And I go, what the fuck is J.C.? And he goes, oh, Jesus Christ. But we won't get any heat from the fucking Catholics, so we won't put the name Jesus Christ on there. We'll just put his initials, and I'll be like, oh, wait a minute, are we saying that he's Jesus? He goes, no. In his mind, he thinks he's Jesus. So we'll make a ton of money off it. I just said, good night, Dennis, and I hung up on him, and then we never spoke about it again. But those are the little – that's what I remember of Dennis, those kind of things, and just like, you know, man, it's just – there would have never been – a big 80s Donnie B, and those are discussions for another day, you know, how that came about. But there never would have been PCW. Anybody that is promoting or had promoted over the last 15 years in New Jersey, none of it would have happened without Dennis.
Yeah, no doubt. You know, I've said before on the show, my favorite late night call I ever got from Dennis was the one where he wanted to he had a great idea for the next show. He wanted to do a feud between the what were they? The Sons of Blitzkrieg, Crazy Ivan, and someone else, the Nazi tag team.
Oh, God, yeah.
He wanted to do a feud between the Nazis and a Vietnamese tag team that he had to find. And I said, Dennis, you know, who's the baby face there? And he's, you know, he hadn't gotten that far with
him. Shit, man.
Yeah. Real quick before we wrap it up, too, you mentioned your wrestling group. Well, you know, it makes me think, you know, Dennis was in the times that we saw him as a performer in the IWA Mid-South feud and Smoky Mountain Wrestling in the USWA in 1992. He was a pretty great heel. Did you ever think about using him as a character on your show?
I can't remember what Super Bowl it was. It was one of the Super Bowls. WWF was in Philadelphia. And it was during the angle with the U.S. title with Cornette and the NWA and all that shit. And it was an afternoon show, and I was back there with Junior and somebody else. And I remember being Keener. And Cornette goes out to the ring, and he does the whole heel promo. He brings out Howard Brody first, right? A little bit of pop, nothing, a couple boos. No indictment on Howard. He's cool. Next comes Victor Quiñones. No reaction. Cornette gets on there and says, and now, last but not least, or whatever, NWA Board of Directors, Dennis Corluzzo. And I swear to God, it was like fucking mid-80s Iron Sheik heel. Like, he came out, and I just remember sitting there saying, holy shit, this is what Dennis should be doing. He needed some fine-tuning with vernacular and public speaking and this and that, but just enough to clean him up. It would be like a rough piece of wood, and if you sanded it a little bit, it would have been better. But, like, if somebody could have took that, and that's what I said to Dennis, like, when he kind of gave me his blessing and I told him I was going to do Phoenix and the shows, I said, listen, I want – he said to me, when the smoke dies down from what happened with him in the NWA, I'll come around your shows. I said, dude, I'm going to use you as a talent. I want you and Mark to come in, you first, get all this heat that you're trying to buy my company. You bought the stock in it. You bought the building I was in, all that shit. We haven't seen you in a while because this is what you were doing. I said, then you're going to bring Mark in. I said, it'll be a father and son team, like the first ever father and son manager team at ringside. It would have been awesome. I said, we'll bring you guys in together. It'll be really cool, and I'll just use you as a talent, nothing else. And he was all for it. He was psyched, and then he died.
Yeah, he would have, like you had said before, he was a natural heel. He would have really
– natural, man.
Like a really good – extended heel manager run, he would have been exceptional. I really truly sure. believe that. I truly believe that. Well, in closing, as we wrap things up today, Donnie, how would you like to see Dennis remembered? And what is the lasting legacy that Dennis left on your life?
Dennis Corluzzo was the quintessential con man / carny / promoter / slick talker, dime store lawyer, all that stuff. When you think of like a carny barker and a promoter, that was Dennis, but in a good way. And like I said, Dennis could be screwing you in one way with a short payoff or something, but at the same time, you didn't care because he was so charismatic and just so cool outside the ring and outside behind the scenes. He would give his shirt off the fucking back for you, would put you up in his house, would give you money for a car payment, whatever it was, Dennis would do it. And I just, for everybody that knows Dennis, there's a lot of people who say, oh, I heard of Dennis. Hearing of Dennis and knowing Dennis are two different things. And the way you can prove that is that Dennis's, one of the best houses Dennis ever drew was his own funeral. And it literally was sold out. I mean, the fucking, everybody was there. Even people, I remember walking around that funeral saying, holy shit, I can't believe so-and-so is here. I can't believe so-and-so is here. And everybody legitimately was upset. And that's how you know, even if you had disagreements, and these are people who you had disagreements with or fallouts with, they still showed up. Because at the end of the day, Dennis Corluzzo was one of the most original, sought-after, hilarious characters that professional wrestling ever created. When you make a list of characters, just these insane characters that can't exist in any other facet of life except for professional wrestling, Dennis Corluzzo was one of them. He's on the list. So to me, that's what I want Dennis remembered as. And for my life, there would have never been a Big 80s. There would have never been PCW. I don't know what I would have done or where I would have been. But where I am right now in my life, to me, I mean, without getting too long-winded, I have an incredible life. And I owe a large portion of it to the skills and the things I learned under Dennis Corluzzo. For me, till the day they put me in the ground, I will always remember Dennis as my friend and my brother.
There it is. Another fine Dennis of the Week. We want to thank Donnie B., my old friend, for appearing with us for the last two episodes. Next week, I think we may have a shorter Dennis of the Week just because we have so many other things going on, but I'll see. We've been fortunate that since we started doing this, a lot of people have reached out to us that they have Dennis stories, not just wrestlers, not just people who worked for Dennis, but people who are friends with Dennis, people who hung out with Dennis, people who went to wrestling shows with Dennis. So we're going to have some really cool stuff coming up in the weeks to come with the Dennis of the Week. Longer ones and shorter ones. So don't think that they're all going to be super long, but also they won't necessarily all be super short.
Didn't Sue Shooter say something like that?
Super short. He wasn't super short. He was very well hung. Next week, part two of Ron Scholar, but also we're going to have part one of our talk with Bobby Simmons, the former referee and all-around office hand for Jim Barnett and Georgia Championship Wrestling. Interesting interview. Lots of stuff I don't think people have heard before. The big problem is, Bix, Bobby was so awesome that we talked to him for about 3 hours. So we got to figure out how we're going to divide this up into – it's going to be multiple episodes. So we just got to figure out how the best way to do this. What are we going to do? What do you think?
I say we just try to keep it going as long as possible and just try to figure out whatever. Like, I'd be fine with even if – I feel like what we should try to do is, like, see the closest we can get to half hours and just kind of keep it going and going and going for however long.
Okay. Well, we'll see.
Like,
you know,
or whatever.
If we could break it up by topic, that'll be the thing. But I'm going to go through it, and part one will be next week. Also next week, I have a bunch of information on this. I'm looking for more, and we're going to see where this goes. But next week here on the show, Bix and I are going to talk about Blood Circus by Santo Gold. That's all I'm going to say about it right now. If you don't know what I'm talking about, go to YouTube, put Blood Circus, Santo Gold, and watch what comes up. And as confused as you'll be, we're just as confused. But we'll talk about it next week, the great lost wrestling movie that may be lost forever. We'll see.
Apparently it is.
Apparently he has the 35mm prints, and he's really asking people to send him credit cards for him to release it, and that isn't going to happen. Because
he hasn't heard of Kickstarter? And people there, too.
Yeah, remember, he went to jail for scam apparently. So we'll talk more about this next week. See what we're gonna do, and either next week or the week after, we got to see how we could schedule it. Our Buzz Sawyer training school segment, which I think everyone's gonna love. It's gonna be really, really cool. We're really looking forward to it. Jason Rudy, if you're out there, we're gonna be talking to you real soon. I'll hit you up, and thanks for listening and for all the help you've been in the last couple weeks. Bix, plugs time.
One thing before plugs, good timing with the Buzz Sawyer thing too, because it's going to be right around WrestleMania time, and of course, who's in the real main event of the WrestleMania this year but sort of Buzz Sawyer student, The Undertaker.
Yeah, who Buzz, I think, what, he took his money and then left Texas?
Pretty much.
Yeah, so that's probably right around the time he went to California to open up. Because I think he went out to California at the end of 86.
That sounds right.
Yeah, so, well, we'll see. I'm interested how Buzz ended up out there. He's from, like, Tampa, isn't he?
I think so.
I mean, he was always billed as being from, what, Sacramento?
Which is where the school was.
Yeah. So, we'll see. But, of course, we know one of his famous students was Ken Shamrock, and there'll be some stories about that. And, as I said with plugs, before Bix gives any plugs, I want to say Bix's Twitter has been awesome lately. If you've been interested in the Hulk Hogan trial with Gawker, Bix is like the one person at the one place on Twitter to check out to get all the details. So, Bix, tell us a little bit about that.
Of course, follow me on Twitter at David Bix. Been covering the trial constantly there, at scscoops.com, and also in Figure Four Weekly for WrestlingObserver.com subscribers. Well, this week's Figure Four Weekly is my review of the EA Sports UFC 2 video game, which I liked a lot. And hey, if you're going to buy it, even if you're buying the download code, because Amazon sells download codes for both versions, for both PlayStation 4 and Xbox One, why not go through tinyurl.com/605Amazon if you're getting the game? As far as the Hogan stuff, yeah, a lot of stuff's been going down.
We need a jingle. We need to come up with a jingle for the tinyurl. I just realized that as you said it. I'm going to get on that. I'm going to get one of my songwriter friends to come up with a jingle.
Oh, boy. Well, anyway, now I've lost my train of thought. If you want to just see all the stuff I wrote about, I've been writing about the case at SC Scoops. The way you could even do that would be to go to scscoops.com/tag/Gawker. And that's that. As far as everything else, there's Between the Sheets this week, of course, which this week, myself and Chris Zellner were joined by our friend Dylan Hales, who I guess after you is now the second repeat guest on Between the Sheets.
Okay, cool.
I think he's the second, right? I don't think there was anyone else after you, was there?
Not that I'm aware of, but I'm a little backed up, so I'm not sure if I missed something, but he's good on there.
And it was our first glimpse of the 2000s, as we did 2004, including WrestleMania 20, the first ever ROH WrestleMania weekend show, which was also the first show after the Rob Feinstein Preferred at Justice thing. So we've got that. Lots of stuff going on in Japan. We talk a bit about 01 and how much we... I mean, I guess 01 still exists, but how much we miss that era of 01. All sorts of stuff, so that's that. Of course, TNA wackiness, too. Whenever TNA existed, there was always wackiness. And I guess that's it as far as Between the Sheets, and I guess that's it for this week. I have my new Fighting Spirit article coming out about the UWF national expansion that Bill Watts did. I think that might be next week. And I also have a new web article coming out in a couple weeks that I'll plug when it gets closer to publication. So that's it. Brian, what's coming up on the Jim Cornette Experience and whatever else you may or may not be involved with?
Oh, always good to tease a plug that's not there yet. That's I don't know about that philosophy, Bick. I have something else I'm going to be plugging soon, but I can't tell you about it now, but I will be soon.
I just don't want to get people's hopes up until I
That's exactly what you do. What you're doing is building up hope for something. Anyway,
it's reverse psychology.
This week on the Jim Cornette Experience, where I am the co-host, as always, we have a fun talk about various things, including some political stuff and some wrestling stuff. And then Jim talks with David Fuller, the promoter of the Parade of Champions coming up in Dallas, WrestleMania weekend, I guess, Thursday, or it's sometime that WrestleMania weekend. Listen to the Jim Cornette Experience at MLWRadio.com for more details on that. At this point, I want to make a real quick Nikita Koloff sound. Ric Flair, as always, as Bick said, tinyurl.com, 605 Amazon for all your shopping needs. Buy soap, buy books, buy anything you need, and use our code, and we get a few bucks. If you are so inclined to make a donation to the show, we have a donation tab on the bottom of each post at 605pod.com. You could pick myself or you could pick Bix, and you can send a few dollars. If you're a millionaire and you're just looking to dump some money, you don't want the government to know about it, give it to us.
Why is it an either or?
Well, because there's no group way that the money could be split evenly. So we got to give the people the option of picking where you want the money to go.
Well, it can go to both. It can be
and
both.
I've gotten so far about $750,000 on there. So thank you. Bix, how much have you gotten?
751,000.
Yeah. As we said earlier, our book recommendation for the week is The Last Outlaw by Stan Hansen. Check this book out. If you get it from Amazon, 605 referral code, use that. I just gave it before. But also, if you go to Crowbar Press and get it from Scott Teal, let him know you heard about it here. He's a friend of ours, and he's been a supporter of the show. So let him know that we are supporting him, and we really appreciate what he does. Facebook, join our community. Talk to us. Communicate with us. Suggest things for the show. Hear what's coming up on the show the day before, or sometimes a couple days before, depending on when we actually get this stuff done, Bix. That is Facebook.com.
That was pointed.
No, that was just throwing it out there. You guys have no idea. Sometimes Bix and I get everything done early, and then sometimes life is in disarray. I got to go to a science fair in a few minutes for one of the kids. But it is Facebook.com/superpodcast, Facebook.com/superpodcast. Join the party. Let us hear from you. We love hearing from you. I always forget something.
Yes, there's iTunes. If you look, subscribe to the show either way. If you use iTunes, subscribe to the show on iTunes, as you would with any other fine podcast. We're on there. If you're on Android, you know, use whatever podcast app you use to download us, whether it's Downcast or Beyond Pod or Double Twist or anything like that. And the other thing, of course, with iTunes is please leave a review. Even if you have iTunes but you don't use iTunes as your podcast downloader, leave a review anyway. Leave a 5-star review. It actually helps, as strange as it sounds. So leave not just a rating, a review. Write a review about how great we are. And you can do that at our iTunes listing. And, of course, that is linked at the bottom of every show post. And see, I took care of that so you didn't have to. Is there anything else?
Very good, Bix. Yes, you can follow Bix on Twitter at David Bix. You can follow me on Twitter at Great Brian Last. If you want to have a conversation about the show, please use the hashtag 605pod. Not anything else, because people are using all sorts of wacky shit.
And tag both of us, of course.
Yeah, and tag both of us so you only have 28 characters left for your post. But yes, use the hashtag 605pod. And I think for the first time ever, we've successfully gone through the plugs without missing anything.
Well, you forgot it, but I didn't.
I didn't forget it. You didn't give me an opportunity.
iTunes. No, you said I'm forgetting something.
You didn't give me an opportunity.
But you said I'm forgetting something.
I just want an opportunity. He didn't forget, Bix. Bix, tell me about what you want to do to Abdullah the Butcher's blading scars.
Oh, God.
Okay, guys.
Okay, my friends.
Next week, Bobby Simmons, Ron Scholar, Blood Circus, and a whole lot more. Until next week, he is David Bix. I'm the Great Brian Last. Tally-ho!
Yeah, Hector, tell him in Mexican just to get out of here.